Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. If you can't hear me, please holler at your girl. Please, please, please holler at your girl because, you know, technical issues. Okay, technical issues and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was a poem by David Romano. And if tomorrow starts without me, oh, what a beautiful, 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 beautiful piece. So today is the 9th of the 7th month, 22. Hey, the 9th of the 7th month. Ha, I'm reading the time as months. It's 7 minutes past the hour of 9, guys. Ah, it's not that deep. Good evening.
Good evening,
Tate Buena. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you too?
I'm fine, thank you. Talk to me. How have you been? How was your weekend?
Ah, mommy, it has been hectic.
It has been hectic, huh? Mm. What were you doing? Tell me all about it.
Ah, a lot of things are happening, mommy.
Like what?
Confusion.
You are confused about what?
Psychological stress.
About what?
A lot of things, special issues.
Like what? Like what? Like what, Tate Buena? You have to tell me. Like what?
Honest and good woman.
You know, is she going to take away all your stress?
I believe so.
Are you sure? Or is she just going to help you carry it? Kucha, is she just going to maybe help you carry it? She's not going to take everything away. She's just going to help you carry.
Or if you are to help each other to carry, this one is carrying this one, this one carrying this one, at least we meet halfway. Maybe it's with the balance.
Yeah, that's true.
Kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you talking about today?
Well, today we are doing story time and you can tell us your story and I can tell you our stories and I can tell you the stories that I've heard. Yeah, I spent my whole day yesterday binging.
The whole day, what happened?
I spent my whole day yesterday binging on African stories and stories of people. And it was wonderful. So that's why I'm asking, hey, what is your issue? What is happening there?
Oh, I mean, issues are complex, my friend.
Then why don't you want to share?
I will share the story tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But all I'm saying is that a lot of confusion.
Really?
Very much a lot of confusion.
Really?
So many try to, they say, okay, you cannot be lonely. And then I was talking to one of the madam.
Mm.
And her husband passed away some years back. Just a few years back.
Mm.
Professor.
Mm.
And then he was talking to that mama. Mama, how are you? No, the children just took me out. Back to get around this loneliness. And, you know.
Mm.
So, for her, it's a male mama. And, and then I was now reflecting on some of these things.
Mm.
We, our brothers and others,
perhaps.
Are we also not feeling lonely? Is this something not going to push us down?
Mm.
So you think of women, virtuous ones, and what? You face this side, you face this side, nothing is materializing.
But what are you looking for in a woman? Let's start there. Because maybe that is what's stopping the love from happening. Because I don't think, after all these years...
Nothing else.
So the women that you have found, they don't have respect them?
I don't think that many of them... I mean, I'm just looking, but I'm thinking particularly now looking. When I'm interacting and asking all this interrogating.
Why are you interrogating people? Are you an officer?
Eh?
Why are you interrogating people? Are you an officer?
What?
You must not interrogate people. There's a difference between asking people questions and interrogating people. Interrogation is very harsh.
Oh, but because you can also have some harsh things.
And then, no. How am I going to end up in a relationship with you if that's how you ask questions? Like you're interrogating me. Hey, babe. Hey.
No, it's not like that.
Hey. How many kids do you have? What happened in your past relationship? Hey.
Why are you taking these people? Hey, no. So, I just wanted to know what you are talking about. Because I haven't listened from the beginning. Now that you are saying that you are telling the story, I don't know, so many stories, I don't know which one to tell. But I will think of one that's so soft. The one that seems to have element of interrogation. So maybe in the polite way. But I'm just thinking that this social dynamic, you know, this social relationship, and because I was actually trying to build them on but it, the last week actually when we were talking and you brought in some people who were telling us about life issues. So I got to one of them that one of the points that talks about how we can create cohesion in the relationship and things like that. But I don't know, it appears it's very different. I'm observing and I'm also receiving some, a lot of complaints. So men are being abused in most of their relationship, marriage. And they are saying that the law is not on their side. I'm asking, what's the issue?
Why do you think men are being abused?
So, I think people are just taking advantage of them. Women take advantage of them. Because many of those ones who are abused are the humble ones, the tolerant ones. And once they behave in that manner, soft one, soft way. So women do take advantage of that.
But I think that gentlemen have a tendency of choosing rough women.
I think so.
Yeah, gentlemen have a tendency of choosing rough women.
These rough women that you are choosing now, how do we end up now when you are so
proud? No, but you are just supposed to choose a gentle woman also. You are a gentleman, you must have a gentle woman.
I could have also somebody who is, but you know, it's very difficult to not them, you know, until when you're getting there and sometimes.
But at the Bwana, nobody just wakes up and decides that they are going to be doing bad things to you or shitty. Pretend for what now?
Just for their own things that are going
on. Aha, where? Nobody just wakes up and decides, I'm going to start hurting this man.
Sometimes it's just the first side, and then you say, I love this woman, you're attracted to me, and what. Before you know what is happening, you're in love. Then you are now expecting these things, and you are naturally saying that you expect so much from these people, and then, you know. So, this kind of dilemma.
Yeah.
So, when there is a bit, let me listen to what you are saying.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. How are you guys doing? My name is The Matriarch and I am your host for this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, today is Monday and we are doing story time on Monday. Now, the reason that I want to do story time, you guys can come through and you guys can tell me your stories as well. Mara, I wanted us to do story time because vele, I feel like we have gone through a lot. And I think it's time for us to hear a story because I know that the stories also cheer you guys up. And it's not necessarily cheer you guys up. They also just, they also give you guys that je ne sais quoi, that boost, that thing of of looking at somebody else's situation and you're like, yeah. All right. But before that, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to listen to another piece, right? And do not love half lovers, right? We're going to listen to this piece. It's a poem. And we're going to listen to this piece with our whole hearts and our whole minds and our whole bodies. And we're going to focus on it. And we're going to hear what the author is saying.
Do not love half lovers. Do not entertain half friends. Do not indulge in works of the half-talented. Do not live half a life, and do not die a half-death. If you choose silence, then be silent. When you speak, do so until you are finished. Do not silence yourself to say something, and do not speak to be silent. If you accept, then express it bluntly. Do not mask it. If you refuse, then be clear about it. For an ambiguous refusal is but a weak acceptance. Do not accept half a solution. Do not believe half truths. Do not dream half a dream. Do not fantasize about half hopes. Half a drink will not quench your thirst. Half a meal will not satiate your hunger. Half the way will get you nowhere. Half an idea will bear you no results. Your other half is not the one you love. It is you in another time, yet in the same space. It is you when you are not. Half a life is a life you didn't live. A word you have not said. A smile you postponed. A love you have not had. A friendship you did not know. To reach and not arrive. Work and not work. Attend only to be absent. What makes you a stranger to them closest to you, and they strangers to you? The half is a mere moment of inability. But you are able, for you are not half a being. You are a whole that exists to live a life, not half a life.
You must live a full life, not half a life, please. Live it fully. Live it boldly. All right. My name is The Matriarch, and I am your host here on Eagle FM from 9 o'clock all the way to midnight. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about a parent's worst nightmare. We're talking about stories that are broad, that people talk about. Like, we're talking. Tonight I'm going to tell you guys stories from parents that have shared their experiences with certain topics. Now, vele, if you guys are thinking that, oh yeah, this is my worst nightmare, maybe it isn't. You know, sometimes when we listen to other people's stories, it gives us that, what do you call it? For me, right, I spent my weekends, or what's left of my weekends, because I work 6 days, right? What's left of my weekends, just trying to regroup and recuperate and just re re-energize and fill my cup again. And I try and do this by all means, in little pleasures that I love. And part of the little pleasures that I do love is, listening. I love listening. And as much as you might not believe me, I am not much of a talker. I don't enjoy talking as much as it seems like I do. I'm good at it and I can, but I'm not, it's not my happiest. I feel like for me, deep conversations are stimulating. Deep conversations are stimulating. And if they're not deep and they're just shallow, so I'm not for that, you know? So I love to listen. I love to immerse myself into the arts and the knowledge and the wisdom and the experiences. I like to dive into things. And part of the things that I like to dive into is, audiobooks. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I listen. That's what I do. And this love was just enhanced by the fact that I am on radio. So, I utilize my ears. I play blind. So it's like I have a blindfold on, and then the only senses that I can utilize, or the only sense that is very important is my listening, right? So I listen for fun. I listen to things that are educational or impactful. So part of my chronicles, my Sunday chronicles, was I was listening to a couple of stories from a couple of podcasts. And I think you've noticed recently that I'm sharing a lot of the stuff that I do listen to. I'm sharing a lot of the different places where I dive into in terms of what I like to listen to and what I like to hear. So ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're talking about a parent's worst nightmare, and we're going to be telling a story. So these are not names. Sophie, and Peter. And okay. So we're going to be telling a story about Sophia, but we are going to call her Sophie. Okay. So Sophie grew up in the township. So she grew up in Soweto. She grew up in Soweto, and it was not a bad childhood or anything, but she comes from a Jehovah's Witness background. So she was born into the Jehovah's Witness, and she basically grew up in the church, right? And you know how religious households, especially with people that are continuously religious, we're not talking about you guys where nobody's forcing you guys to go to church and your mother goes to church twice a year, or we're not talking about that. We're talking about every Sunday, every group meeting, every everything that's happening at the church, they were involved in the church. So Sophia was not an exception to this, to the norms of the church. So it was walking around evangelizing or teaching Bible study and preaching the word of Jehovah, you know? And eventually at some point, I think she was like 21, she graduated, and she went to look for a job. So she went to look for a job, and she was still going to the church, and she moved out of the house. So she moved out of the house to go and live closer to work. And this was now in town. Let's say hypothetically it's Windhoek now. And now she lives maybe in suburbia. Let's say Windhoek West or H Park, P Park, wherever. She lives in suburbia now. So she can't keep going to her congregation because it was in the hood. So she looked for a different church, but it's the same denomination. I think, yeah, that's the correct word. Okay. So she started now going to the JH, of somewhere that was closer to her. And in the church, she met now a wonderful guy. They were at a church barbecue or a church braai, and she saw him, and she says it was love at first sight. When she saw him, he's like, ha, that one's going to be my husband. Oh my God, he's so fire. Woo! like, whoa, he's so fire. He's everything. Oh my God. Even his fingers. Wow. Did you see how the nail grows out of his fingernails? Oh my God. Whoa. I love it for me. Like, wow, he's so fire. She says that it was love at first sight for her and she had eyes for nobody else. And, they didn't do anything. He didn't approach. He didn't do anything. And you know, as a black woman, we don't approach men more. So we just make ourselves We make ourselves obvious and we allow ourselves to be seen by the man. And then the man comes in for the kill, right? And this is exactly what she did. And I'm telling you, this guy, it's like he didn't see it. It's like he was blind, but he didn't have another person. So it's not like he's blind because he's got a girlfriend or he's got a fiance. And also people from the JH, right? They don't do those girlfriend, boyfriend things. They do things, according to scripture, according to the Bible, you know? So it was more of, if you guys are going to go into a relationship, first of all, you guys are going to talk about your interests or in each other here at the church. And then you guys are going to have, a chaperoning you guys to prevent those sex before marriage things. And, you know, to prevent the devil from coming through and associating with you guys, you know? So at this point, she has never had anybody. And this is the guy that she had put her eyes on. So she was hinting at it. And she says that she hinted for like 4 years. Imagine you meet this guy at 21 and 4 years, you're just hinting. Every church, even the ones that you don't want to go to, ne? She's going. Even the ones that she didn't want to, she's going to every church event because she gets to see him most. Yeah, so like maybe today will be the day. Maybe today will be the day that he'll come and he'll talk. So he used to speak casually, you know, hello, Sister Sophie. Hello, Sister Sophie. You know, how are you, Sister Sophie? It's like, bruh, I don't want to be your sister. I want to be your wifey. I want to be your sister. And eventually, like after 4 years, and at this point, she's what? She's 25. At this point, he now makes a move. He's like, hi, Sister Sophie. I've been checking you out for a while and I was wondering if we could do courtship, right? If we could do courtship and see where it takes us. And when they say see where it takes us, it's so that we can get married. Because there's no patapata things, there's no dating things, there's no what. So it's courtship, like where you guys are having a chaperone and like you guys don't close doors. There's no secrecy or privacy there. Okay. So she accepted. She's like, yeah, have you waiting? She didn't say that. She was an African woman. So she played her a little hard to get, you know, like, I don't know. Maybe it's not like, I don't know. And then eventually she caved in. And they started now their courting. So their courting was something like 1 year and 6 months, like 1.5 years, right? And they courted now with a chaperone and people from church overseeing their courting, you know, making sure things are done right.
If you've reached that stage in life where you are tired of everything, where each day is just routine. Dah, yammer me oh. No, seriously, I am genuinely sorry for you. Cause you clearly haven't been polanified. Like, boring day at the spun. Polanify your lunch hour with a delicious Polana curry. Chewing through yet another stale sandwich. Polanify your burger with a little mac and cheese. Tired of chewing the same shandy? Polanify your munchies with air-fried Polana pasta chips. Come on, life's too short for boring. Polanify every moment with Pasta Polana, a proud product of Namib Mills. Care that goes where you go. That's international travel insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
All right. So they started courting and they had a chaperone and, you know, people took chances in chaperoning them to make sure that there's no funny business that's being done because they're serious. Just as JH people are serious. Serious. Yeah? Serious. You know how serious they are? They are very, very serious. Mm? They're so serious that even your courting net must be evaluated and it must be checked and it must be, you know, scrutinized and it must be, yeah. And she says, let's say her husband's name is Josh. Uh-huh. Let's give him Josh. All right. So she says that Josh was very well known and very well liked in the church. And he was also like those lover boys that he was so charming. He charmed the pants out of everybody. He was charming, wonderfully made charmer. He was lovable. He was helpful. He was, you know, gift to the church. He was so for the church and he was such a God-fearing man. And he was everything that she wanted. Like, hey, he's the one to remind you, Guja, you didn't pray before you eat. Let's pray about it. Let's go and pray. Let's pray. Like, let's ask Jehovah. Let's, you know, and he was really just the type of guy that you would say like, oh my goodness. For the church sisters now, because Mina, I don't want that. I don't want that. Forced prayer. For me, it would be like forced prayer. For you that wants that, it would be like a gentle and friendly and loving reminder. You see how we view it? Same thing, different views. Eh? Me, I would be like, you are forcing me to be praying every time. And then you that wants that, right? Preference. You'd be like, my God, a daddy. I love that. I love it when you remind me to pray before bed. Ooh, I love it when you send me that text of please pray. Ooh. I love it. I love it for us. You see, you'd love it. And she loved it. So he was very well liked. The whole society where they come from, like it was nice, you know. So after a year and 6 months, they finally started planning for the, after a year, they started finally planning for the wedding. It would be in 7 months, right? So they started planning for the wedding and after 6 months they got married and they moved in together and they started their lives. And he was working somewhere and she was also, you know, working. She is a teacher. She's a qualified teacher. So she works like in the morning until afternoon. So at this point she is 25, right? 25 and a half, turning 26. So at this point, she's like, yeah, we are ready. Onses sharp. So she's like, baby, you're such an amazing guy, you know? So let's have children. And he's like, I don't want children. He said it point blank, I don't want children. And she asked him, why don't you want children? She's like, he's like, I don't want children. I never pictured my life with children. I love children when they belong to other people and I can give them back when they start whining, start crying, or even when I'm tired, I can just go home and there are no children there. I don't want children. I don't think I like children and I don't want children in my space. And he was very adamant about it and he was very serious. So, Sophie was like, yeah, but you're such a nice person. You know, the whole society likes you and you are so helpful and you are such a great husband and you're such a great friend and a brother and like you'd be such a great father. And Oshiriai, this man is not budging. He doesn't want. Year one goes. I don't know now what preventative measures they were taking. preventative measures they were taking, Mara, no, there was no baby coming because he didn't want a baby and he's not trying for a baby. Nothing like of that sort was happening. So they waited for a year and they waited for 2 years. So now the first red flag here, the red flag is when somebody tells you they don't want children, believe them. We have a tendency of forcing people to have children because we think they're so amazing. They're going to make amazing fathers, right? Like, I want. And these are most probably the conversations that you guys are supposed to have before you guys get married. Mara, you don't want to have these conversations. You're just going to parcela him a little bit. So after a year, she's still forcing, you know, she's forcing the whole year. She's forcing a second year. She's forcing the third year of marriage. So in the third, in the second year of marriage, right? And at this point, she's like 28. At the second year of marriage, he finally caves in and he's like, okay, fine. You know what? You're begging me for 24 months, 2 years. So fine. Let's just have one. Let's just have one child. There's only one child that we're going to have. And she's happy and she's like, yay, let's have a baby. We're going to have a baby. And then they got pregnant. So he's not even shooting blanks out here. Yes, sharpshooter, you know, land straight on the target, like first time around, like whatcha, as Ben and the World Cup, there's a baby conceived and she's happy and he appears to be happy. So during pregnancy and everything, he's also hands on, you know, rubbing feet and doctor's visits and he's doing all of this, you know. And time for delivery comes and the baby comes. It's a baby girl. Let's call her Naomi. Yeah. Oh, Naomi comes and Naomi is the light of the parents' life. Naomi is absolutely wonderful. She is loved by both the parents. And then the joy in the house comes because it was only the two of them and the house was like a 5-bedroom house. Because they were doing well, you know, they were doing well, like really honestly, they were doing well. So she's like, oh, Naomi, you know, mother dearest, Me Sophie. Hey, Me Sophia. She's like, oh, Naomi needs a sister. Naomi needs a brother. This means that no, I don't want any more children. You said only one child and I don't want any more children. And she's like, but Naomi's going to be playing alone. The man is like, I don't want. And so life continues. And it was the three of them, you know, the parents and their baby. And, so the baby was always in between the two grandparents. So his parents and, the Sophia's parents, right? So because the kindergarten was close to both the grandparents, it was easy. So 1 week she goes here, in the morning, she gets dropped off at the grandmother and then the grandmother walks her to school like around 8:30 because school would start at 9. And then the grandmother would pick her up. And then the other week is the other side and the grandmother then would also just drive to the kindergarten. And Naomi was basically, really honestly shared amongst grandparents. She was not the child where we are so stingy with our baby. Our baby is not going there. Our baby is staying here with us. Only no. She was definitely like she was set with her parents, with her parents' parents. So she used to visit on both sides and then she would spend time. And it was an easy routine, you know. Mom drops off the baby and then dad goes to work whenever because he works shifts and all of that. So it was fine. And at some point one day when Naomi was 3 years old, right? The mom came home and Naomi was already home. She was there with her dad. So the dad had to go to work and she was bathing Naomi, before they eat dinner and all of that because it was only the three of them, right? And it was the three of them and they didn't have a maid at the time. So it was just the three of them. So she was bathing Naomi and Naomi was 3 years old at this point. So Naomi says, right? She says that, no. Mommy, daddy peed on me here at the cookie. Ha. Sophia says that her heart sank. Her heart sank all the way to the bottom of the jungles of death. Like she didn't understand, like, what was the child saying? And at the time, Naomi was three. So she's like, okay, she got up because they were laying down. After the bath and everything, they went to lay down. She put on cream. She put on cream in the baby, and then they laid down, and then the baby said, like, no, mommy, daddy peed on me here at the cookie. And my God. So she gets up, and I think that when she got up, she kind of shocked the child. Like, the child was scared. Like, she felt like the child felt like she did something wrong or something. And then the child says, no, I'm lying. You know, quickly. No, I'm lying. And the Sophia says, like, no, Nana, you can tell me. Like, tell me what happened. What did he do? Tell me what happened, you know? And the child is like, nothing. You know, nothing. But it was basically out of fear. She says that the child looked more afraid of the mother's reaction. So Sophia gets up, like any sane mother would do. When your three-year-old child tells you, Papa peed here, and she's pointing at the genitalia, then it's most now game down for all us normal, like for all us normal parents, it's most now game down like that. Because also a three-year-old, like a three-year-old, how, you know? So she gets up, and there she gets the child, and they get into the car, and they are going now to the doctors, to the emergency room. On her way to the emergency room, she calls her husband, you know, and she's like, no, Naomi is sick. I'm taking her to the hospital. And the father is like, no, but what's wrong with her? And it's like, no, you know, that lie that you must tell. Because I mean, if the child is accusing this person of doing this, I wouldn't even call. Like, she says that she feels like she was so hypnotized in the relationship that she does, like, half the things that she has done, right? When she thinks about it now, she's like, why would I do that? You know? So she blames herself a lot. So, she calls her husband. Her husband is like, oh no, let me know what is happening. So she goes to the hospital. And they take a swab, like, you know, and they do the rape kit of the baby, and they do, you know, they do all of the whole test, right? And then the doctor says now, like, no, there was semen found. There was semen found, but there was no penetration. Guys, I hope you guys are listening. You guys must call me and say, Kucha, we are listening, Maitreya, we are listening. Ne? The number is 083-288-401. So they semen found, but there was no penetration. And the doctor basically says, like, no, like, so this is what happens, and this is the specimens of what has happened, and these ones were going to be sent to forensics and she's now done there. So while she's there, child protection comes, and then the police also come, because when cases like these are reported, the police is notified and child protection is also notified, right? So somewhere there, while the child is still getting the test, the police come, and then they're like, oh no, mama, what's happening? I know, the child told me this, and I just brought her, you know, so that she can get evaluated, so that I can see. And also keep in mind, right, that Sophie is a teacher. So such cases are within her alley. As educators, one of the things that you are taught also to identify is when a child is being violated or abused in any way. So nothing that the child says that is in those lines is ever taken lightly. So child protection comes, and then it's like, oh no, all right, no, we're just here to observe and to evaluate and to see. And the police is like, okay, us also. So the doctor comes back, and then the doctor talks about, no, there's semen, Mara, there's no penetration, and what else, I know. And yeah. So this is what happened. And the child says that maybe it could be that she was dreaming, but she's not really sure if she was dreaming or she was awake. And that's basically it. So, fine. So they finish at the hospital and it's like 10 o'clock at night. Now the problem is that so the man had knocked off a long time ago, but the man didn't come to the hospital. So for me, I'm listening and I'm like, Mara, me, if my child is making such, like, if my child is talking this type of thing, ne, I will tell, my boss, kucha, HT, I have to go because this is the situation on the ground. I will not even be able to work. But at this man, he worked and then he finished his shift and he was just basically like, you know, like he went to Kelevent a little bit in Bera and it's like a person that doesn't care. Okay. So it's fine after that. After that, it's now time to go home. And the people are like, so at the time she was not driving. So she didn't drive. She took a cab. So at the time she wasn't driving. So the police, drove her. So they didn't go straight to her house. They went to the police station. Now the police officers are like, no, just come and make a case. Or even if you don't make a case, just come and report it as something that is suspicious that happened, because it, just come. And she's like, no, but the man is her biological father. And you guys heard what the doctor said. The doctor said that there was no penetration. And then the police officers are like, but they see men. Like, so even if there was no penetration, right? It's still a sexual violation. Oh yeah. And, before we go any further, ladies and gentlemen, for those that have been in situations like this, I'm so sorry. This is a very triggerous conversation. Please endure and allow the conversation, but it is very triggerous. Yeah, it is definitely very triggerous. It is definitely very, very sensitive. So listen with your heart in your hands, okay? And then if the heart becomes to pump too much, put it in cold water. So she starts arguing. She's like, no, but this is her biological father and biological fathers don't do this. It's usually just stepfathers and uncles that do these types of things. And it's her biological father. He would never do this. So even if I was going to make a case, against who am I going to make a case? And the child is not damaged. And she's going on, you know, she's going on with the police and the police are saying, just come and put it down. Because if you put it down on paper, right, we can always find it. Even 10 years from now, if anything happens, there'll be a paper trail. Start the paper trail. She's like, no, my dear, me, I'm not going to do that to my husband. I'm not going to do that to my husband, and I'm not going to break up my marriage over something that didn't happen and accuse my husband and my husband and my husband and my husband and my husband. And nothing in her speech said, and my child. It was just my husband, my husband. Whoa, deep, ne? Hectic. So finally the police is like, okay, if you don't make case, you don't go to the police station, so they dropped her home. And at the time, she's now checking the time because he has a specific time that he comes home. So she's checking the time and she's nervous, right? She wants to be there before him. So that, you know, she can ask or something, right? So she just feels like the police is wasting her time. Anyhow, so the police drop her home. They get into the house. They close the doors. And then she puts the child to bed. And then she sits. And while she's sitting, the husband comes in. Not long after they got home, the husband comes in. And then she says that she asked him, like, did you do something to our daughter? And he's like, do something like what? Like, no, did you like ejaculate on her or something? Like, what did you do? And he's like, I did nothing. And he was like, oh my goodness, I'm so disappointed in the way that you would think of me and how dare you. And this is my flesh and blood. And this only happens with stepfathers, but me, I'm her biological. And oh my God, how can you? And he went up. And this is a person that has never shouted in all the years that they've been together. He has never shouted. He has never argued. They had had a perfect marriage, perfect relationship. There was no arguing. There was no fighting. And this was the first time that he was upset about something, and he couldn't even look at her, and it was, he's just not a shouter. So after she confronted him, and that was the reaction, she retreated, and in that retreat, she felt shame, and then she felt guilt for ever thinking that he was capable of doing something like this, and for ever thinking that her daughter was right, and she just felt so much shame. Right? And bad. And at some point she's like, and he's like, yeah, you must never ever repeat this to anybody. You know, you must never repeat this to anybody, must never tell anybody of this incident. You must not talk about it. You must not, because how can you make me feel bad like this? And oh my goodness. And he basically manipulated her, guilt tripped her, gaslit her, everything all in one. Right? And she decided that she's going to keep quiet. And this was when the child was 3. So after 4 years or so, they had another baby, you know, because she was now forcing, because you know, babe, Naomi needs somebody to play with. Naomi needs somebody to play with. And he's like, no, 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 I don't want, I don't want, I don't want. And then, you know, eventually he caved, and then they got another child. So this was after 4 years. So the gap is 4 years between the two children. And it was another baby girl. So at this point, Naomi was something like 7 years old, and she was doing good in school. She was doing good in school, and life was normal and life was fine. And then when Naomi turned 8, she started peeing herself. She started peeing herself, and it elevated, and the peeing herself was not, it was not peeing like, what do you call it? It was not like peeing the bed, right? It was not like peeing the bed. It was like she can be standing and then she pees herself. She can be hearing a loud sound and she pees herself, or she's just sitting in the class and you just see the pee running. And it's just, she just pees herself. Now, this peeing herself, right, escalated to cacaring herself. So she started excreting on herself. Like, she started pooping on herself as well. And she started peeing herself. So the bed wetters. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're not learning anything from me, learn this one thing from me today. Bed wetters, right? If your child is a bedwetter and your child stops bedwetting and then goes and picks it up again later, then your child has a problem. Then there must be a problem. And most of the times it's sexual violation, you know. I know this is a very heavy conversation. I was, you know, and I was thinking about it. I was like, oh, it's going to be such a nice story. I forgot the, like, how heavy it is. It's heavy. It's a very heavy-hearted conversation, but I feel like this is something that you guys must hear. You guys must hear so that you guys take care of your children and protect them. Because you guys are their guardians. Protect them, please. So Naomi had taken a gap from 3 years old. She was not wetting the bed from 3. And then she starts now again to start wetting the bed at 8. So there was a gap of 5 years. So a bed wetter, a normal bed wetter, a child that wets the bed doesn't take gaps. doesn't take 5 years break of, oh, for 5 years, I'm not going to wet the bed and I'm just going to start wetting the bed. And then on top of wetting the bed, she's also carrying herself like, no, there was a serious problem. So she went, she took the child to a child psychologist. And the father was like, yeah, this is nothing. It's nothing. It's just that you just like wasting medical aid, and every small problem is just medical aid. Every small what is just medical aid. You like wasting medical aid. It's nothing. She'll get over it. And this was the father's sayings, right? But she knew there was something that was wrong. So she went to the psychologist, to the child psychologist, and they did, They did, the play therapy. They did the play therapy, and in the play therapy, the psychologist, that's why when you get a diagnosis, when you get a diagnosis of something, I believe that if your heart is unsure, if your heart is shaky about the doctor, get a second opinion, especially when it comes to your children. If your heart, the parent, if your heart is shaky in any way, right? If you don't buy what the doctor is saying, get a second opinion. Don't ever take it for granted because your intuition doesn't lie. Get a second opinion, okay? So they did play therapy with the child, and they did it for a couple of hours and sessions and all of that. And the bed wetting and the cackering kind of stopped a little bit. It was minimalized. And after that, the diagnosis now came back. And it was said that no. And Sophie says that she felt like this psychologist failed her tremendously. Failed her tremendously. And the psychologist comes back and says like, yeah, your child is terrified of the teacher. Now, the term terrified is a big word. If somebody says scared, right? It's more calm. It's more relaxed. But when somebody says like terrified of the class teacher, terrified of the class teacher. That's why she's peeing herself and she's pooping herself because she's terrified, right? You're like, yo. So the psychologist comes back and says like, no, your child is suffering from, she's terrified of the teacher, and you must move your child from that school with immediate effect. Don't recommend. Like, no, your child is going through a lot of trauma, and your child is traumatized, and your child, you know? And like any good parent, she says that she felt like, no man, but this, it can't be. You know, because Naomi's a verbal child, she would have thought that, nah, no, teacher is doing this, or teacher is scary, or teacher is something, but never anything about that teacher. But all of a sudden, the teacher is the cause of all of this. So they move Naomi. And after that, Naomi went from, you know, grade one and grade two, she went from being an A class student, you know, an A, B student, to just use. Like, the child started failing. The child is not listening. The child is just bad. It's like terrible. It's bad. The child is just not performing at all. And Sophia says that after that, she has never ever excelled in school ever again. So it has just been kongenge, like just 50s, just barely making it. She has never gone back to really learning after that. After that dip or that decline. And they moved the child and the bedwetting kind of stopped, but it was minimal. Then eventually it stopped at like the end of the year. It stopped completely. And you know, they were having fun and things just went back to normal. You know, loving house. The man doesn't shout. The relationship is smooth and awesome and beautiful. And there was no shouting. There was no nothing. You know, he was just a good guy. There was nothing. The kids are doing extremely well and it's great. So at some point, So at some point when Naomi goes into grade six, right? At this point, they are now, she's now having the third child. Because after the two girls, she was like, no, but we need a boy to carry the name. And the house is big enough. You know, she needs a boy to carry the name. And then one day she found pills in the house and she found like eye drops in the house. And she asked her husband, but the husband never gets sick of anything. He only ever has sinus, right? So she assumed the eye drops and the other, it's like little pills, right? They were his, and she asked, like, whose pills are these? Are they, these the nanny's pills? And she's leaving pills out here, but we're having kids. What if the kids take her pills? Before she goes on, the husband is like, no, it's mine. I just forgot it. It's like, oh, okay. So what is it for? He's like, ah, no, it's for sinus and all of that. So in grade six, Naomi starts wetting the bed again. Naomi's going through a lot. Ah. Naomi starts wetting the bed again. And at this point, she's like, ah, no, but Naomi, man, like, ah, what's happening? And Naomi's like, no, I'm just having these dreams, funny dreams, but it's, and I'm always tired and, you know, and she says like, okay, but also with her, she's like, lately she's been waking up extremely tired. And then also she also started noticing that, you know, when somebody has coitus with you and then there's dirt all around, like semen. So she would wake up and in the morning and she would have to ask her husband's like, oh, now did we do it last night? And the husband would be like, no, we didn't do anything. Or the husband would be like, yeah, why don't you remember? So she's thinking like, no, she's starting to have memory loss. So this started happening now. Then one night she woke up in the night and she woke up and she was very drowsy and she was going to the toilet and Naomi's room or the girl's room was there and she walked and then when she walked, she looked into the room because the lights were on. She looked into the room and what she saw was her husband on top of her 12-year-old daughter. Oh, 11-year-old daughter at the time. Her husband on top of her 11-year-old daughter. And her 11-year-old daughter was just laying stiff, right? And she says that when she saw it, she just fell over. So she fell over and after that, she doesn't remember anything. So she just woke up the next day in bed. And she's like, was I dreaming? Mara, if she was dreaming, right? Then why is she in pain? So she has blue bruises all over that, like her left side, like somebody that fell. She has blue bruises, but she says she did, like she dreamed. So she doesn't know if she was dreaming or what was that. She couldn't comprehend it. And she couldn't know to ask her husband. So she's just, you know, thinking and pondering about it, like, what was that? You know? And she went to church and then she went to talk about it because now her body is aching. Her body is sore and she's got bruises, but she doesn't remember falling and she doesn't remember getting to bed and she doesn't remember anything. And it seemed like she was just dreaming. And when she asked her husband is like, no, we were sleeping the whole night. But she's like, but I have bruises. And he's like, I can't see anything. How? But I have bruises here. You can't see this blue spot here. No, I can't see anything. Maybe you were just dreaming. What did you dream about? And she's like, nothing. She can't really say. So she went to church to talk about it. You know, she went to church and went to talk to one of the elders in the church, the overseers in the church to talk about it. Like, no, last night I had a dream that this was happening to my daughter and my husband was doing it, and I don't know what that is. And the overseer is like, no, you were just dreaming, Sister Sophie. And she's like, yeah, but I have bruises, like a person that fell down, because I remember I fell down when I saw it. Then why do I have the bruises if it was just a dream? Like, how can you wake up with bruises from a dream and you didn't fall into anywhere? The people are like, no, Jehovah is going to help you see what. And they basically turned her back like, ah, no, nothing is happening. It's fine. And okay. So she goes home, and a couple of, maybe 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, she's looking for something. She's looking for something. And the husband is like, I think she was looking for like a screwdriver. She wanted to like fix something there. And she was looking for a screwdriver. And then the husband is like, no, the screwdriver and all my tools are in the toolbox in the garage. Just go inside the toolbox and go and get the tools inside the garage. So she gets up and then she goes to the toolbox. And she opens the toolbox. Now, in the toolbox, there's like a little compartment there. And she checks in the compartment. It's one of her handbags. Now, do you know, Ne, when you have so many handbags as a woman, when you are well kept and you take care of yourself, you tend to have like a lot of things. So handbags are one of them. So even when you are missing a handbag, right, you wouldn't really notice if you have many. Not unless it is a specific handbag, you love that handbag, you want to use that handbag, then you'll notice that it's not in the other handbags, you know? So she noticed it's her handbag. And when she notices that it's her handbag, she goes into the handbag. And she takes the handbag out of the toolbox. Now she's forget the screwdriver. What's my handbag doing in my husband's toolbox? So she goes into the toolbox and then she takes out the bag, and then she opens the bag, and then the bag is empty, but you know, there's always those kazipikismos. Now inside that kazipiki, she looks inside it and she finds Naomi's leggings and panties. Now, Naomi's leggings and panties, right, are full of blood. Like, and you know, when you wash, when you bleed on something and then the blood stays there maybe for too long and then you try and wash it, it always has that brown spot, right? So she notices like the leggings and the panties, but these leggings and the panties are like from different years, you know? Like this one is 3 to 4, this 4 to 5, 5 to 6, 6 to 7, 7 to 8, 7 to 9, like that. And she's like, what? And she goes to her husband. She's like, this day, okwaria tokora. She goes to her husband. She's like, what is this? Like, let's just go there. What is this? What are the child's leggings and panties doing here? What is this? And why do they have these blood stains? Like, what is going on? This man has the audacity to say in the calmest voice, stop bothering me. Stop bothering me with your nonsense. And then he walks away. So Sophie, at this time she's driving at least. So Sophie, she takes the kids, all three of the kids, right? She takes the kids, they get into the house, they get into the car, she grabs her handbag with the medical aid, eh? And then they go to a private hospital, or they go to the hospital, and she decides that she's having all the children checked for sexual violation. So they get rape kits and they evaluate So the youngest one was a year and a half at that time, and he's a boy. So when he was checked, there was nothing. And the middle child was also checked, and there was nothing. But with Naomi, Naomi was checked, and there was something. Now, at this point, they took samples from that. They took samples from that, and they took samples from that, and then they sent it to the forensic lab, but it tested positive for semen there also, like semen there also. And also, they checked to see if she had been sexually violated, and they did. And it was there. And then they also now went to a neuro person for the brain, and for, they went through all the tests, like for a neuro person and then for a psychiatrist and a psychologist. And then there's apparently this test that they do with rape victims, like with their brains, and there's a chart that is given. So there's different estimates on this chart where they check where somebody that has been sexually violated once, somebody that has been sexually violated 2 to 3 times, somebody that has been sexually violated 2 to 3 times in over a long period or over a short period, and then somebody that has been sexually violated continuously. Then the doctor called her in without the child, called her in. Now, he evaluated the child, or she evaluated the child. It was a female doctor, because the male doctor that was on the floor that day refused to evaluate Naomi, because it would have now been a violation. If she was violated, then it would have been a second violation. It would have been a second trauma that was inflicted on the child now. So they had to first wait for the second doctor to come, which was female. And then the doctor stayed with her for like 5 hours. And then after that, called the mother in. And this whole time, this father, he's at home doing his things and then going to work and then just, you know, living his life. No phone call, nothing. And they were there, and then the mother is called in, Sophie is called in. And then when Sophie was called in, the doctor explained the chart. And then she also explained that, okay, if I am to read your brain right now as a married woman, as a happily married woman with an active sex life, your brain chart would look something like this, like you are having sex on a regular basis. This is not the brain scan of a child, or this is not the chart of a child. This is not supposed to be the chart of a child. This is supposed to be the chart of a married woman. So whatever is happening to her is happening to her on a regular basis. Who do you stay with? Like, no, it's just my kids and my husband. And the housekeeper comes now and then, most, but the housekeeper is a woman. So it's just me and my husband. And the doctor asks, is it her biological father? And she says, no, it's her biological father. Are you sure? Because maybe you would have done something, you know. And she's like, no, I'm sure, because I went into this marriage. I went into this marriage a virgin, and I've only ever had him, and it has just been us. You know, so there's no one, I'm 100% sure. And the doctor's like, well, I'm not accusing your husband of anything, but I know that this is saying that this is what is happening, but I'm not accusing your husband of anything. She kept saying, I'm not accusing your husband of anything. I'm not accusing your husband of anything. I'm not accusing your husband of anything. So she kept saying it, but she's implying that it's him. It's him that is doing this to the child. And Naomi decides that no, she's going to the police. She goes to the police, and then she makes a case. So now she finds this officer. Now this is where law enforcement, I don't know. You guys must do better. Like, what is, oh. Law enforcement must do better. So she gets there and she wants to open up like a rape case. You know, she wants to open up a rape case against her husband for violating the daughter, you know, and basically this man decides that he's not going to open this case. He's not going to open this case, and he's also not going to arrest the man, because a biological father would never do this. And she's saying that, but he's the only man. No, a biological father would never do this. And Sophie is one out of five children, and all her brothers are boys, and they all live at her parents' house. So this man is like, yeah, but are there other men in this child's life? It could be uncles. Uncles are the ones that do this. And Sophie is saying that even if it was uncles, right, it wouldn't be on a regular basis, because this child stays with us full time. So she would just go for a weekend with all her other siblings, one weekend in a month to one side, one weekend in a month to another side. But 90% of our time and this child's time, she is with her parents. So it must just be the father. This man decides that, no, you're just using me. Now at this point, right? Apparently this man was very charming. Her husband was a very charming person. He was known by everyone, including the officer that she went to, including the officer. So this man is determined that no, your husband Josh could never do this, because he's a very God-fearing man. He's a loving man. He's a kind man. I even remember the other time where he used you guys, he used his own money to pay for the people at the church to go for a fun day and a road trip and what. So this man would never do this. And you just want to divorce the man and keep his things, because you are poor and you are a gold digger, and Mr. Josh from church would never do this. And this is like, this is a law enforcement man. This is a police officer. No, I'm not going to open it. And he refused, you know, he refused to open it. So with all the lab tests, and then she's like, okay, fine. It's fine. Let's not open it. How about just give us the paper? So we send this one to the forensics so that they can go and determine DNA wise and samples wise and what. And then he sent that one in. And then he also said like, yeah, when the results come back, you will come and apologize to me, because it's not your husband. You just want to cover up for your brothers, that your brothers are doing this and your cousins are doing this. And this man is like literally making this woman's life hell, right? And the samples are sent in to the forensic people. Samples are sent in. So everything is done. The cases are open. The what is open. Everything is opened. And I think the child is also starting to hear and starting to see and all of that. So the kids are all there. So they get into the car and then they drive back home, because where are you going to go? So now it's in the middle of the night and she's contemplating, must I go to my mother? You know, I never, ever, ever want my children to be in a situation, where they must go back to the dangerous place, because me, I love my in-law so much, or they'll feel judged by me. Because she says she went back home to her marital home because her mother loved her husband so much, and she would never actually be on her side, even if she told her, Kucha, this is what this man is doing. She wouldn't believe, because he's such a loving person. And narcissists are like that, ne? They are loved by everybody. Oh, he's so helpful. You know, he's so nice. And she says that the relationship between her mother and her son-in-law was so nice that, the mother would even introduce him as, no, this is my oldest son, or this is my son. And people would believe, because there were similarities. They used to look alike. So there were similarities, and people would just believe it. And that's how close they were. So even if the mother was calling at 2 o'clock at night, this man would run to his mother-in-law and he would do anything for her. And that's how he won her over, you know. He was such a great guy. You know, those great guys that are so great. So great out here. So she's standing at the crossroads, right? And she decides that she's going to drive home. So she drives home. And she gets into the house and she parks the car. The children come in. The children are standing and then they are now on their way into the house. And he's standing like at the door and he asked Naomi, like, "Hi, Naomi, how are you?" You know? And Naomi looked at him and then she's like, and simpy. And then she walked away, you know, because of what he's been doing to her, and then walked away. And then the other two children, the middle one was carrying the baby. So they also all just went to sleep. And she went to sit down. She went to sit down. And she started crying. Like, how can you do this to your own flesh and blood? How can you be violating this child like this? Why are you doing this? Like the narcissist he is, he didn't deny it. He didn't nothing. He just said, like, stop bothering me. Leave me alone. I'm watching TV. And then he puts on his TV and then he puts on volume. Then he closes, like, he puts on volume and continues to watch. And she looked at him. Just looking at him while she's weeping. And he gets up and he's like, "Ah, you're making noise. I'm going to sleep." Then he goes, then he went to sleep. And she says, like, that was the first time in all the years we've been married that we slept each one your side, back to back. And she says that It was like the end, you know? So she says that she was so in denial of what's happening, right? She started becoming forgetful. She started like zoning out, you know, because of the trauma. Started zoning out and then she got like, they are forensic psychologists or something like that. She said something along those lines, forensic psychologists that go and determine how things were. So the child had a session with a forensic psychologist to determine where or what it is and what happened and the crime and. So the child had a session. So in the morning, she woke up, she packed up her kids and then went to drop, you know, don't tell the child. Apparently she was told, don't tell the child anything. Don't talk about it even. Just drop her off and then just hand her over and say that you're going to come and pick her up. It's fine. So she went to drop Naomi off at the forensic psychologist. And then like after the whole day, they spent the whole day from 8 o'clock all the way like until 4 o'clock. And then 4 o'clock, mama came to get the baby now. And then they excused Naomi and then they sat in the office and the forensic psychologist is like, I don't even know if it's a thing, but they said it's a thing. So the forensic psychologist or the forensics person said that, okay, so there is something that's happening in your household. Or there's something that has been happening in your household and your child is singing the same song. I stayed with her for this whole entire day waiting for her story to change, but her story remains the same. She remembers what is happening, but she remembers what is happening as dreams. That no, she dreams that the bad man. Now who is the bad man? No, it's Papa. The bad man is getting on top of me and then he's doing these things. The bad man. Who's the bad man? No, it's Papa. Papa is the bad man. Papa is doing this in my dreams. And the psychologist also says that, okay, so what we have determined, right, was that something is happening in your household that you are not aware of. So are there any medications in your house? You know, because you don't give the answer. You ask so that your patient gives you the answer. You ask in such a way so that your patient gives you the answer. Are there any medications? Does your husband take any medications? It's like, no. There are these kinds of pills. There are these kinds of little pills that he has in his backpack and just eye drops. He doesn't get sick. We are the only ones in the house that use that medical aid. Even like he doesn't get sick, nothing. Even if he gets sick, he will just do home remedies. He hates hospitals. So he just does home remedies, bite ginger or bite garlic. And then in a day, he's fine. So he has a very good immune, but he does have eye drops and then he has this. So the forensics person is like, yeah, well, eye drops, ne? I used. Have you ever seen your husband using the eye drops? So now she's like, yeah, but my husband is an adult. So no, I've never seen him using the eye drops, but I see him refilling them and buying them. So the forensic person tells her now that eye drops are used as sedatives. They are date rape drugs. So somebody puts like a dose of eye drops in your drink and then you pass out. And she's like, hey. And is it this brand of eye drops or this kind of eye drops that contain this? And then she's like, yes, it's these ones. These are the ones that he uses. And he's like, okay. And then these pills, do they look like any of? Then so the forensic person gives her now like pictures to identify which these pills that she has seen in her house. Do you remember when she was asking when she was accusing the nanny? Then the man said it's his. So he goes now. She looks through and then she's like, no, these are the pills that my husband has. Kanti, the man has Mollies, like it's like a date rape drug that. Basically, this man, what he's doing, right, is dragging his whole entire family so that he can sexually violate his daughter and sometimes his wife. That's why she wakes up with semen all over and feeling like she did something yesterday, but she doesn't remember doing anything because she just went to bed. And then she's also been having memory loss, like she doesn't remember. And it seems like the day that he was doing it and she woke up and fell on her hip like that, it's like he didn't give a big enough dosage or something to knock her out. So the forensic people told her like, no, this is what has been happening, but the memory is too traumatic for her to pinpoint it as a real memory. So she pinpoints it as a dream. She views it as a dream. So it's not a memory. It is a dream, but it is a dream because she was drugged. So when she's drugged, she thinks that it's a dream, but it's not a dream. It's actually happening. You know, that disassociation and just being drugged, you know? And this woman cried. Sophie cried like a parent's worst nightmare. Like, hey. Sophie cried. She stayed in that office and she says she cried. And she cried and she cried and she cried and she cried. It was bad.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So Sophie is in the forensic people's office and she is weeping for dear life. And now it's time to go home most now. Now she has her answers. So now the case is open. It's not opened because they are still waiting for the results. Now she's calling every day. Hey, what are the results saying? What are the samples saying? Because the people also came. Because it was now a case, most now. It was a case that was, it was more like a query. I don't know what the officer did there, but the people came and also took samples from the husband, you know, to match the DNA. To see if it's his DNA. And, so those samples she's calling every day. Ah, no. The samples, like, are you guys not done with the samples? And the people are like, no, we are done with the samples. We have already submitted them to the office and what. She goes to the office there at the police station. Ah, no, there's nothing. Ah, there's nothing. Ah, there's nothing. So she called the elders. You know, she called the elders from the church. Kuja know from home now, her side and his side. And She came to sit there and she told them what is happening. And Naomi's paternal grandmother, Naomi's father's mother, says that Naomi likes boys. Every time she's always just talking about boys. Boys, 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 just boys. So maybe she's just having sex. And the mother is shocked, like, no, like, it's not, Naomi's not doing that. It is your son that's doing that. And the people are like, yeah, but he's a biological father. He could never. He's a biological father. He could never. And the man finally admits that no, he's doing it. And he's going to turn himself into the police. And then his mother stops him and says, Kucha, you're not going to turn yourself into the police. You're not going to go and die in prison like your brother died in prison. You're not going to prison. We will deny it. Even if you go to the police, we'll deny it. Yeah. Now Sophie goes to the church. The church like, there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do. We are not going to talk. We're not going to, there's nothing we can do. She goes to the police. She went to a different police station. And finally, like after 5 years, so she decided that she's going to move out. And she moved out and found a place and left the man and started finalizing her divorce with him, because how can he do such a thing? And after that, she's still battling with this thing. She's calling the people, yeah, the results, so that we see more, so that we can finally put him behind bars. Because every time he says like, yeah, no, you know what? I'm going to turn myself in. You know, man, like, I'm so sorry. I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I'm sick. I think I'm a pedophile. No, I'm going to turn myself into the police. You can come and get me. And then we go to the police station. Like, and she would go and pick him up, you know, with the family, go and pick him up. And then they would go to the police station. And then when he gets to the police station, he changes like his story. He's like, what do you call it? A consent father. Like, yeah, I just came to inquire about my daughter's case. How? No, I just came to inquire about my daughter's case. So finally, after 5 years, she went to the commissioner of who and what. And she went to the topest office. And the topest office, them, they went through the is it a detective, Uka? At the time, he was an officer and he's a detective now. They went through his files and all of that at work. And then they found that the people from forensics that took the samples name,
the samples had been sent like 1 month after the samples were taken. So this man deliberately, ne, obstructed justice. Deliberately. And then he went for a disciplinary hearing. And he said, like, yeah, this woman was just trying to use me to finalize her divorce. And her husband even told me that she just wants to take everything and she's a liar and it's not what. And so show us now the results. Then the results came back and, the specimen was apparently tampered with and no, the specimen, it came back. The DNA was positive and everything was fine. It was positive. And then it was now time for her to now open the case and do the things. And then, there was an expiry date or something. And then she had to go and get the specimens. And then everything was missing. Everything was missing there. At the forensic people, like, oh no, we have the sample going in, but we don't have the sample coming back, going out, but we don't have the sample now. We cannot match it with any DNA. We cannot do that. It's not a what. It's not a what. It's just a runaround. So nothing happened. The man didn't go to jail as we speak. He's still living his life. He's still loved by the community. They still think Sophie is lying. And they still think an 11-year-old is a person that was playing around. Because she was in grade 6 because she started school early because she was too smart. Now the smartness just disappeared there by 8 years old. It just disappeared. And what she's saying is that she wish that she was not blinded by the love that she thinks, right, was happening here. She wish she listened to her 3-year-old. She wish she listened to the police officers that told her, make a case. Make a case so that you have a paper trail, so that you have a CR number. And I think that with domestic violence cases, right? This is exactly why things don't go accordingly. Because when somebody does something to you, you don't go and report them. Now, when something goes down for real, right? The reason that that person is still out on bail and coming to kill you after they're out on bail is because there is no history of violence. There's no history. There's no paper trail. The paper trail is important. Even if it's just that is it an OB, okay? Or something book where they just write that you came to make a complaint, a formal complaint about something. You're not opening a case, but you're coming to tell what happened to you so that it is on police records. And she's saying that she regrets that. That's her biggest regret and that's her biggest nightmare. Because she was wondering, who did I marry? This man. How can he do this? And the fact that the whole entire society is saying things like, yeah, but it's her biological father. It's her biological father. I think that we as society think that some things are beneath us. But we as human beings, fear a human being. And Naomi's 24 now, this year. Naomi's 24. And this is a real story, ne? And Naomi's still battling with depression. And she's battling with, battling with depression and she's just battling with life. But some days are good. Sikunawa, sikunai. Some days are good. Some days are really, really hard for her. She's 24. She's grown. She's thriving. She's trying to thrive and trying to live. And then the youngest is a boy, right? So now at this point, he is something like 11 and he wants his father. So he was told about the story. You know, he was told that what his father did and how it affected Naomi. And he loves Naomi so much and he understands, you know, that I know what Papa did was bad, but he still wants his father. And that is now why Sophie feels so betrayed by her son. Like, she feels bad because by the time all of this went down, he was only a year and a half going to two. So he didn't really honestly get to experience the father at all. He was too young. So now he's asking for his father and he's calling his father and he wants his father and he wants to go and live with his father. Now, in that case, like, do you explain in detail how much of a monster the father is? And like, I think that that's the hardest thing that a parent can do. Like, trying to shield your child from someone that they want so much, even though this person is bad for them, like literally like bad, bad for them. But the child, like, I don't care what he did. He didn't do it to me. He did it to Naomi. To me, he won't do it. I'm a boy. And she says that she ignored so many red flags. And she also, there were some family secrets that also came out in the meetings that apparently this child molestation, right, is something that came from their father. Like, the husband's biological father used to do that to them as children. And he just, I think that's why he didn't want children, because he didn't want to become that person. And then now your wife forces you to have children. Like, and we're not condoning it. We're just looking at it like in its true form. I always say that with people that have been molested, for example, right? Oh, this is such a sensitive conversation. I'm trying to tread carefully without pulling heartstrings, you know? With people that have been molested or had witnessed or been a part of sexual violation when they were younger. When they say they don't want to be around children, please believe them. And also, let's check each other's psyche before we have children, you know? Let's check. Okay, so something like this, like, check it. So now, she says, like, one of the red flags, right, was that there's a guest room in their room. And this guest room was the room where she had the dream that the father was on top of her child, right? So it wasn't their room, it was a guest room. And when visitors come over, they sleep in that guest room. So at some point, her father-in-law came to visit, right? Came to visit, and when he came to visit, because he's a senior, right? Because he's a senior, she assumed, when she changed the bed sheets, she found like the brown stain, right? That brown stain that just stayed like a brown stain, like blood, right? But it's most now brown. So she thought that it was her father-in-law that had an accident. But if she would have thought, she says that if she would have thought about it a little bit sooner, she would have like put two and two together, which, no, that thing that I dreamed, it really happened, because here is the evidence. So she just thought it was like, father-in-law made a choo-choo, he made an accident. And his father, like, she says she cried so much, you know, she cried so much because this is a parent's worst nightmare. I think many of us must look at this story, this particular story, with real eyes. Like, like with real eyes. Because do you know how many children report sexual violation to their parents and their parents don't believe them? I know 3-year-olds lie. I know children lie. But even if children are lying, why would they lie about this thing? No, because they want to break up the relationship. Why would they want to? They can break up the relationship with other things. They can break up the relationship with telling you that, no, you are sleeping with somebody else. Or lying about infidelity or something. Or stealing or something. But, eh? Did he touch me here? Ah, no. Papa did this. Ah, mama did this. Or uncle did this. No, my brother would never do that. You guys have the audacity. I think that we forget that these children, especially when it is our relatives, when it is our siblings or something like that, right? And I'm having this conversation with you, with you out there that has been in a situation like this, and you're like, matriarch. We have a tendency of protecting the monster. We do. We have a tendency of protecting the monster because the monster is our brother, and our brother could never do that. Our husband could never do that. The teacher could never do that. How do you know? But why is your child the culprit, but not other people that you didn't give birth to? Other people are not culprits, but you, your child, must be a culprit. Why? I think many of us are in denial, and many of us want to keep our homes intact, keep our things intact, our marriage intact, our relationships intact. Keep them in one piece. But why? What are you trying to save there? What are you trying to save? So this story, ladies and gentlemen, is an identifier of, let us learn how to identify red flags. When someone says they don't want children, and they make you wait for 4 years within a relationship to get a child, maybe you must believe them. Maybe you must believe them when they say they don't want children. Because now you are giving birth selfishly to these children so that these children can come and suffer at the hands of this person. Because I believe that if she just didn't have these kids, right, like her husband wanted, they would have been the ideal couple. They would have never been this pain. And now she gave birth to a person that was going to be abused. And I think that the husband knew that those urges would come in. And that's the thing with pedophiles, right? Pedophiles are so dangerous. Pedophiles are so, so dangerous. So, ladies and gentlemen, that was our first story for the evening. Phew. If you would like to contribute, the number in studio is 083-288-401. Maybe you can come and ask a few questions. Maybe we can talk about it. Maybe we can be like all shocked together. It's a very heavy story, but it's the reality of so many children. We as parents don't want to believe our children. Yeah, my stepfather is touching me. Hey, my father is touching me. My uncle is touching me. My mother is touching me. But you guys are not, going in depth. There's a cousin of mine that has a 3-year-old that was sexually violated in the house, right? And she's just living her life. For me, it would be devastating. Like, I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid. So, let this conversation be a reminder that the world is dark out there. It's dark. It's dark out there. Take care of the kids. Listen to the kids. Protect the children. If they talk and they say that this is what happened to me, you know, take them to the hospital. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, before that, let's do a quick breather and then we are going to look at green flags, because we focused a lot on the red flags and there are so many red flags. One, this guy doesn't want kids. Two, there's no relationship without arguments, guys. If it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. And three, narcissists, identify narcissists. Narcissists, what they do is make the whole world love you. And when they want the world to turn against you, the whole world will turn against you because they are so lovable. Until even the police are like, yeah, this man is a great man. Like, how are you not supposed to be in the middle? Are you not supposed to be neutral? Yeah. Are you not supposed to be like not taking sides? Are you not supposed to just let like justice prevail or something? You're telling, I'm not going to do that because you're just using me. How?
Lipuranenge no wapubwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utite okoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito danjuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge fata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kongerewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, before we go any further, ladies and gentlemen, let us have a conversation, or let us listen to a conversation about green flags. Green flags are yes, thumbs ups and high fives. So before you start dating somebody, this person must have these things. Okay, so this person does this. So like, I like that. That's a green flag. That's a green flag. Many of us are so adamant on the red flags, right? Because the world is such a dirty place, such a dark place. But there are good people out there, and it is just up to us for us to identify them and make lives with them. So let us see what the green flags are in people, not just the opposite gender, but people, so we can apply these green flags, right? Maybe even to our friendships, our relationships, our work environment, and our coexisting on planet Earth. Ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of the clips or audios that are displayed within our show. They are strictly for illustration and for information purposes only. We are not saying that this is ours. We are just saying that listen to this. We also heard this. Like, this is a nice thing here. Maybe you guys can learn. And who better to say it if not the horse's mouth?
All right, so here's the problem. Everyone's obsessed with red flags, right? Narcissism, avoidance, gaslighting. Is my partner secretly manipulating me? And I get it. We have to protect ourselves. The last thing I would ever want is for you to get into a relationship with someone who eventually neglects or takes advantage of you. But here's the issue. Actually, there's two issues. One, the absence of red flags doesn't mean the presence of green ones. And two, especially when we're dating, there aren't going to be very many red flags at first because we're all in our best behavior, especially a narcissist. So then what's the solution? The solution is, yes, absolutely learn about red flags. Learn about what shouldn't be present. But just as important, also identify what should be present, what green flags you should look for in a partner. Because once you truly understand green flags, it's so much easier to spot red ones. And that's not always the case the other way around. Just because someone isn't a narcissist doesn't mean they are a good partner for you. In fact, according to the experts who deal with spotting counterfeit money, they even admit they don't waste a lot of time learning about all the fake bills out there. They spend all their time studying the real ones, the way they feel, the way they look, the details that others would miss. They learn about what real actually looks like, and then it's so much easier to spot a fake. And that's my hope for you. If you learn about what real love looks and feels like, if you learn about what you deserve, kindness, mutual respect, reciprocation, emotional safety, it's much easier to spot the fake versions of those. It's actually counterproductive to spend a whole lot of time analyzing, is this person a narcissist? Because even if you're asking that question, this isn't the right person for you because they don't have the green flags that you know you deserve in this relationship. It doesn't matter if they're a covert narcissist or if they have avoidant attachment or if they're just a jerk. They clearly don't care about a healthy relationship with you. And that's all that matters. If you forget everything I say in this video, remember this. The largest green flag for your relationship is how do they make you feel? Do you feel safe around them? Do you feel prioritized and respected? Is there consistency or are they hot and cold? Because that would make anyone feel anxious. Do they reciprocate the effort you're putting in? Are you scared to be honest with them about how you're actually feeling? Or how about this one? Are you confused about where you stand with them, even after months of being together? Because that's your answer of where you stand with them. Someone who sees you as valuable and wants this relationship to work will put in the time and effort, and it will be evident. We all prioritize what we value, right? No relationship is perfect, but I promise you, if things don't start out healthy, marriage doesn't fix that. I don't need you to have a perfect relationship. I just need you to have a mutually respectful one. I need you to have a safe relationship. I need you to have a relationship where you both care how each other feels loved and valued. There's nothing that we can do to control every variable to make sure that our relationships work. But what we can do is set ourselves up for the best chance at success by becoming the right type of person and picking the right type of person. So let's talk about what that looks like. All right, let's start this list already. Let me know in the comments what I forgot to add. All right, number one, don't get serious with anyone who hates dogs, right? I mean, those people just tend to be weirdos. All right, that was just a joke. I was just seeing if you were all still paying attention. Seems like you are, so we can move on to the real list. Number one is always going to be communication. When you meet someone, of course, it's physical attraction that you notice first, but it's how you communicate and interact together that's going to make you either want to continue seeing them or move on to someone else, right? It's a green flag if they can actually listen to you and take an interest in what you're saying and ask some appropriate questions. It's a red flag when they turn everything back to being about them. I think we can all agree humor is a green flag. Are they able to make jokes without coming across as rude? Are they only making jokes about you, or are they giving themselves a hard time too? Because too many people can dish it out, but not take it, right? Another great trick is to listen to how they argue with other people. Listen to how they disagree with people about politics or religion or other things that they're passionate about. Can they do it with respect? Can they allow someone else to hold a different viewpoint or perspective without dismissing or invalidating them? That's going to give you a big clue for how they're going to handle important conflicts with you one day. I think it's a green flag that once you start to get more serious, you can talk about important issues together. Ask how long they normally see someone before they make things official and only date that one person. Ask them what annoys them the most about how other people handle conflict. What did they fight most about in their last relationship? Ask them about what respect looks like to them. Ask them about what it looks like for someone to value them. Ask them about any boundaries that are important to them. We think having these hard talks early on might lead to disconnection, right?
And if we're talking about our story and we're looking at all these green flags, right? I think that that thing of having somebody always there to overlook, and I'm not bashing the church or anything, right? I'm just saying that this whole courting thing, not having real privacy to actually open up and talk about these conversations prior to getting married is also one of the red flags that we must identify, because this was her first boyfriend. This was her first everything, right? First everything. And this is where she landed.
But it's actually the other way around. Having these talks and setting a standard for how you both want to be treated and how you want to talk to each other, especially during a conflict, is exactly what prevents disconnection later on. If you're worried that talking about your boundaries with someone is going to turn them off, that's not your person. No one is going to set a standard for how you should be treated. That's your job. All right, number two, when they see a dog approach them, do they get excited or do they have this look of like disgust? What's that? I'm being told we've already discussed this. Okay, I'm so sorry. I'll move on. Number two, everyone says narcissists are going to trick you in the beginning, which is true. But here are a few areas narcissists really struggle faking. One of the green flags I want you to see in any new partner is accountability. Can they admit when they've made a mistake? Can they say the words, "I'm sorry"? That's a green flag you need to see. And I get it. In the beginning, there's not going to be a lot to apologize for, hopefully. So we forget to pay attention to this, but have you ever heard them say, "I'm sorry" to anyone? Not, "I'm sorry you feel that way." Not, "I'm sorry you took it that way." How about, "I'm sorry I hurt you. That wasn't my intention, but I care about how my words and actions affect you. Can we talk about this?" Because everyone messes up. Mature people learn and grow from their mistakes. Immature people always find a way to blame someone else so they don't have to reflect or change, right? Now, the other side of that coin is when some people get called out, they develop this attitude of, "Woe is me. Oh, I'm just the worst. Why would anyone want to be with me? You should just leave me and be with someone else." That's not humility, accountability, or maturity either. That doesn't make them a bad person, but it's a sign that there's some healing that needs to take place. Because you can be prideful and never admit you're capable of making a mistake, or you can be shameful and think you are a mistake. Neither of those actually repair the hurt or rebuild trust with your partner. The other thing a narcissist doesn't fake well is empathy. It's a green flag when someone attempts to step into your shoes and actually tries to understand what you're experiencing while validating your experiences and feelings as real. A narcissist has no intention on doing that. The truth is, empathy plays a massive role in whether your relationship makes it or not. At the center of most of our issues is distance and disconnection due to a lack of empathy from one or both partners. Empathy gets curious. Empathy seeks to understand by asking questions, and it's especially hard to ask questions about a hurt that you might have caused. "Tell me about what led you to feel that way. What meaning did you give that? What do you need from me to repair this and feel close again?" There's a big difference between fake empathy, someone saying, "Yeah, I know what you're going through," and real empathy. "I don't know what you're going through, but I can see that you're in pain and that matters to me. I'm right here. I'm willing to talk whenever you're ready, and I hope you feel supported and loved throughout this." Another thing a narcissist rarely fakes is actual vulnerability. Can they talk about their fears? Can they talk about their needs, wants, and desires? Can they talk about their insecurities and flaws that they want to improve upon? Rarely have I ever heard of a true narcissist having any desire to connect with themselves or share in that way. I'm not saying you need to bare your heart on the first few dates. Of course, that type of oversharing can be unattractive. But if you're getting serious with someone, it's a green flag when you can both actually be vulnerable and honest with each other about your inner world. The last green flag that a narcissist really struggles faking is that they will never celebrate your wins. When you get that promotion, when you achieve that goal, it's a green flag when someone can give you admiration and praise. They can say, "I'm so happy for you. You worked so hard. You deserve this." It's a red flag when someone says, "Great job, but you would have never been able to accomplish that without me and my help." People who say that kind of stuff are so insecure on the inside. They have created this fantasy world and they project their insecurities onto you because their entire world would come crashing down if anyone else was deserving of praise. And if you grew up hearing something like that, my heart truly breaks for you if you had a narcissistic parent like that. I hope you realize that that had nothing to do with you and everything to do with their own shame and guilt and fear on the inside of them. All right, number three, if they do hate dogs, there needs to be some sort of a story around that. Did they have a traumatic experience when they were young? That's forgivable and understandable, but let's work through that healing and face our fears so we don't miss out on interacting with one of the world's most lovable creatures, right? Right. Also, it's a green flag if they have a growth mindset. And I don't mean just for their job, which is really important in itself that they're willing to work if they're able. I just mean, do they care about growing as a person? All this research that I'm doing about relationship dynamics, do you know one of the largest roadblocks that I keep seeing? People aren't self-aware. They aren't emotionally maturing. They have no capacity or desire for self-reflection, which is essential if we actually want to connect and experience intimacy and closeness with another person. I mean, think about it. If you don't value your own awareness and connecting with yourself, you're really going to struggle staying connected to someone else. And I know because that was me. If you have a habit of dismissing your own feelings and needs, of course it makes sense why during conflict you dismiss their feelings and needs as well. The only problem is that's the fastest way towards disconnection. So how do we become aware? We intentionally start paying attention to what we're feeling. We look into our conflicts. We reflect in those difficult moments and ask questions. "It seems like I got really defensive back there. I wonder why." We check in with ourselves. "Something's going on. I'm upset. Do I feel overlooked, blamed, neglected, unappreciated? What happened to lead me to feel that way? And how did I express that? Did I get passive aggressive and critical? Did I shut down and pull away? What did I actually need in that moment that I wasn't getting? And did I actually communicate that to my partner, or was I too afraid that it would just lead to another fight? We can all struggle with this stuff. It can feel very foreign, but when we don't understand our own feelings and emotions, we don't have the capacity to understand our partners either. And if we dismiss and push our own feelings away, we will push theirs away too, and that will lead them to feeling very alone. We need to be mature enough to look into our own destructive defaults that we all have, like contempt, having a superior attitude, or yelling, or defensiveness, or name-calling, or invalidation, or shutting down, or even being passive-aggressive. If we don't at least bare minimum pay attention and take accountability for our own faults and admit these aren't actually working, they're not helping anything, then of course we're just going to repeat them over time. It's a green flag when you're dating someone who is actually interested in becoming a better version of themselves. Again, this isn't about perfection. It's simply an acknowledgement. If you hurt your partner with your mouth, with your words, if you avoid and shut down, then you have something you need to change, as we all do. I'm not saying you're broken or flawed, but I am saying if you want this relationship to be mutually fulfilling, you need to learn a new strategy because this one isn't working. It's a massive green flag for both of you to become safe places where each other can learn about how to identify and express feelings and needs. Most of us did not grow up in safe environments where we were able to do that. But what happened to us isn't our fault. Healing from it is our responsibility, right? So become someone safe that your partner can share with. Now, here's the disclaimer. Of course, we have to be careful. I'm not saying your relationship should just be full of complaints. That's why Dr. John Gottman says that we should be aiming for a 15-to-1 ratio in your relationship. 15 positive interactions of affection and admiration and appreciation, smiles, hugs, jokes, laughs, to every one negative interaction. But this is so important. The goal isn't to get rid of the negative. The negative emotion is still super important. And when our partner expresses a negative emotion vulnerably and respectfully, let's work to see the hurt underneath that complaint and the unmet need under their frustration. It's a green flag when someone asks questions about your experience or your feelings instead of just dismissing or defending or invalidating. It's a green flag when someone validates what you're going through as real. Even if they don't agree with all the details, they can still take accountability. I'm not saying that apologize for things that you didn't do. I'm not saying validate accusations that aren't true, but are you willing to take accountability for any unintentional hurt? What that sounds like is, I'm so sorry. I can see how when I told that joke about you at the party, that really hurt you and you felt rejected. That was wrong. Thank you for telling me how you feel. And then we change accordingly, because the best apology is changed behavior. Lastly, how you manage conflict is oftentimes going to be the determining factor of whether your relationship thrives or dies. So learn how to do it respectfully right off the bat. Trust me when I say it's worth the risk of discomfort to be honest about your boundaries, because conflict is either going to build trust and connection or it's going to break it. It all depends on how you both handle it together. Number four, it's not a red flag if someone doesn't like cats. Cats are very self-centered. They really don't care about anyone but themselves. I'm not saying we should be mean to them. I'm just saying if narcissism was an animal, it would probably be a cat. What's that? I'm being told they're all done with this joke. Okay, we're going to move on. Another green flag is, do they see you as an equal? Because if they do, there shouldn't be any dominance in this relationship. You never deserve for someone to speak down to you or call you names or touch you when you don't want to be touched. Dominant people have no issue looking down their nose at you and making those critical and disrespectful comments towards you, but they would never tolerate that same behavior from you, would they? That's the things that you need to be paying attention to. The moment that your partner or anyone talks to you like that and you think, man, I would never get away with this, that's a red flag, as in a stop sign that needs to be addressed before it becomes a pattern. So often we stay silent because maybe the trauma that we endured early in our life, we have fallen into a submissive role where you feel like you don't know how to stand up for your needs and you don't know how to set boundaries with dominant people. And I can completely understand how scary that is. I'm just here to remind you there is no place for dominance or disrespect or superiority in relationships. It only has one destination. And it's not happily ever after. You deserve someone who cares about respecting your boundaries. And if you feel scared to set boundaries or be honest about how you're actually feeling, I would strongly encourage you to speak to a professional about that. The truth is, mutual respect is essential. That means treating the other person the way you would like to be treated as well, like you're valuable and worthy of kindness and consideration, because you are. We respect our partner by learning about them. What are their preferences and values? What do they need to feel close and loved in this relationship? What are their boundaries around sexuality, conflict, in-laws, work? Self-centered people never think about asking any of those questions, but self-centeredness and love don't coexist. It's a green flag when each partner actually has a desire to feel like a team in this relationship. And teamwork demands that we talk about things like the domestic labor and the mutual chores. It's a green flag when we can check in with each other. Hey, how are your stress levels? Do you feel overwhelmed? Would you even be able to come to me if you felt neglected or overlooked? I mean, you want to talk about the ultimate green flag? That's being humble enough to invite your partner to be honest about how they actually feel, even if it causes some discomfort in you. And I'm not saying that this gives them a license to lash out at you or this is an opportunity to put them down. No. I'm saying when you're humble and considerate enough to ask those questions because you truly want to be a safe place for each other, that should calm their nervous system. If it doesn't and they're still taking advantage of you, that's when you need to speak to a professional if you actually want this relationship to continue. And the last thing I want to say about respect is it's a green flag when you see them respecting strangers. How do they treat people who can do nothing for them? How do they respect their parents, their siblings, their exes? If all they talk about is how terrible their exes were and they don't take any accountability for how those relationships were toxic or immature, guess what? You can just replace their name with your name because that's exactly how they're going to talk about you one day. That's why I always say you need to be talking about your boundaries and needs early on. That's the best narcissist prevention because a narcissist hates the idea of you being assertive about your needs and desires. All they care about is control. If you can't be controlled, they will move on, which will sting in the moment, but it's going to be a blessing in the long run. So don't be afraid to talk about your boundaries respectfully. The only people that punish you for that were the people that were planning to take advantage of you. Okay, number 5, are they trustworthy? Just like dogs are. You thought I was done with the dog thing, but I'm not. Okay, I'm committed to this bit. All right, I'll stop. But you're going to be disappointed when I don't say anything for number 6. That's on all you. I gotta be honest with you, trustworthiness probably should have been number 1. I'm sorry about that. I just thought of it. So if you could pretend that that's higher on the list, that would be great. So what makes someone trustworthy? First, they follow through on what they said they were gonna do. Their actions match their words. They are reliable. And if something happens, if they make a mistake, they forget, of course, we're all human. They own it. They don't immediately blame everyone else or everything else. They apologize and they move on with some sort of a plan or communication for how they're gonna learn and grow from this experience. That's called maturity. 2, are they honest and transparent? That doesn't mean they tell you every detail about their life. It just means they aren't purposefully hiding things from you. Trustworthy people have integrity. That means doing the right thing even when no one's watching you. If your spidey senses are tingling and this new person seems like they're consistently lying or deceiving you or something's off, you're probably right. The truth is, trust isn't simply confidence that someone won't cheat. It's the foundation of a healthy relationship that everything else rests on. Trust is actually a sense of safety and security that this person cares. If I need them, if I can reach for them, they will be there for me. They show up. I know that I matter to them. So the $1 million question is, do you trust them? It's a massive green flag when you're with someone who actually cares about building trust in this relationship, because that means showing up and putting in the work. It builds trust when we care enough to ask, is there anything I can do for you this week that can help you feel valued and prioritized? Because most of us have never heard that. But that's what love actually sounds like. It sounds like intentionality and curiosity and effort. And let me be clear, I'm not saying that people should say this from a place of anxiety or fear, like constantly checking in. Is everything okay? Do you still like me? Please don't leave. I'll do anything. Of course, that would be a turnoff for anyone. That's not maturity or love. I'm just saying that when you care about someone, check in with them, reassure them. Hey, if you need something, if you feel like something's off, I want to be a safe place where you can share that. That's what builds trust over time. Intentionality, mutual sacrifice, mutual respect, consideration, affection, attention, safety, vulnerability, putting in the work of selflessness and emotional connection together. This is what makes your bond strong. Ignoring this stuff just weakens your bond. And you'll wonder why years later people say, we just fell out of love. No, they didn't fall out of love. They never actually had love. They had chemistry. They had passion. They might have had a trauma bond. They had the bedroom. They didn't have trust or safety. I promise you. They never built their relationship house on a strong foundation. Spending a lot of years together doesn't result in connection, does it? That's because it requires something from each of you. It requires protecting against and repairing disconnection, which happens all the time in our relationships. All right, number 6 is independence. Now, it's normal in the beginning. We all want them to be obsessed with us, right? But it's actually very attractive when they don't make you the center of their universe and vice versa. I mean, just think about it. Everybody's so concerned with narcissists, right? One of the first tells of a narcissist is them love bombing you, showering you with attention and love and praise, telling you they've never felt this way about anyone, right? Twin flames. All while slowly isolating you from your friends and family. But if you really cared about avoiding a narcissist, then you would slow down in the beginning and maintain your life outside of this person. I'm not saying don't see each other. I'm saying it's a green flag when you can both maintain a life separate from each other at first. Have a great time together, sure, but I have a tendency to throw on my rose-colored glasses and fall in love quick. So if that's you, you probably need to slow down and make sure that you're not making them the center of your universe. It's also a green flag when you can see that they have other healthy relationships outside of this one. Do they have healthy friendships? How do people at work talk about them? Do you feel comfortable around their friends? Because I've seen those alpha male videos where they teach guys how to ignore girls so that they'll like them. They aren't allowed to initiate. They never give a compliment. They play these games where they're very distant and they never text you because that's what they were told. Makes you want them more. This is manipulation, and it's called being an a-hole. And it does work with some women, but it's usually unhealed people who have had some trauma in their life, and they're used to chasing people for external validation of their own worth and value. So congratulations, you triggered her abandonment wound to get her to sleep with you. What a great example of a real man you are. Not to mention that all of these alpha males never have consistent, stable relationships, because being an a-hole might attract women. It doesn't keep them. All right, moving on. I think it's a green flag when a person you're dating has purpose in their life. They're driven towards some sort of a goal, right? They're already a well-rounded individual. They aren't looking for you to save them. It's attractive when someone doesn't actually need us, even though that seems counterintuitive. That doesn't mean they don't want you in their life, but they don't need you to be happy. Now, of course, this can get tricky because some people are so driven, they prioritize work and hobbies above everything else. And it slowly becomes clear that they don't actually want or have time for a real relationship where they need to put in the effort that connection requires. So that's just something that you'll have to decide on your own. All right, number 7, let's talk about some green flags around personality. Everybody's personality is different. I get that. But when it comes to dating, I think it's a green flag when they are flexible in nature, that they can compromise. I think it's super important to pay attention to how rigid people are. I'm not saying they're wrong to freak out when plans change. I'm not saying that they're a bad person when things don't go exactly the way that they wanted to. There's a lot of people who are neurodivergent and they can't help it. But it's still something that we need to pay attention to because it might not be a good fit for you. For me, it's a green flag when someone has an attitude of gratitude. Do they tend to look out for things to be grateful for, or do they tend to filter through the negative? Do they appreciate life, or are they just so stressed that they can't go a few minutes without complaining? I think it's a green flag when someone's intentionally appreciative. They go out of their way to offer encouragement. They're supportive. They're generous. They're thoughtful. You told them about your job interview tomorrow, so they texted you an hour before and said, "Hey, you're going to knock it out of the park. I'm really proud of you, babe." These are the little things that people fall in love with. These are the little moments that build the most trust and help us feel loved and supported. It's greeting them at the door, giving them a hug goodbye. It's playfulness. It's your humor. It's having fun together. It's intentionally setting aside time to reconnect through talking and touching and doing something with them. Doing the dishes so they don't feel like it's always their responsibility. Learning about their dreams and desires and needs. This isn't the extra stuff. This isn't going above and beyond. The experts all agree. These are the essentials. The bottom line is who you choose to be in a serious relationship with and who you choose to give your body to and who you choose to marry and have kids with is a really big deal. And even though I've never met you, I really do care about you. And I just want you to be set up to have the most fulfilling relationship possible. And some of that is becoming the right type of person. And some of that is choosing the right type of person, right? And what we don't realize is some of you have never experienced actual safety and trustworthiness in a relationship. Sometimes we need to realize that we're attracted to what's familiar to us. So let's be honest with ourselves. What are you familiar to? Being told that your feelings are a burden? Working hard to feel loved and accepted? Always being the one that sacrificed for others? Giving, 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 but never receiving? Because we are naturally drawn to what we know. And if subconsciously you know you aren't worthy of selfless love, you're going to be drawn and have chemistry with partners who support that narrative and don't prioritize you because neglect feels normal to you. It feels safe for you to have to work for their love and acceptance, just like you did in childhood. And we get caught accepting breadcrumbs and actually getting used to the chaotic nature of unhealthy love relationships where there's no consistency and there's a lot of fighting and making up. And one minute they're hot and the next minute they're cold. We can get used to that, but that's not the love you deserve. The truth is you deserve selfless love. You deserve a partner who compliments you and appreciates you, and you deserve safe, consistent, warm love. You deserve reciprocation. That's what love is supposed to look and feel like. And you're not asking too much by wanting a partner that shows those green flags. Thank you so much for watching. I can't wait to see you in the next one. And if all... Okay, we all know that if...
And you see, you deserve all the nice things in the world. Just like our friend here is saying, you deserve all the nice things in the world. And now let's look at the red flags, and then we take it from there.
If you don't pay attention to certain red flags, they could destroy your relationships. Doesn't matter how much you love each other. If you miss certain red flags, it causes conflict and it puts strain on the whole relationship. So let's talk about my top five overlooked red flags. Number five, different life stages. Being at different life stages can easily set you up for eventual conflict and disconnection. And of course, in the beginning, you feel like, well, we can make this work because it's super fun and we both like each other a lot. But unfortunately, so often we're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. And eventually, it's not going to be fun anymore. And it's going to be a whole bunch of unnecessary stress. Sometimes you're both just at a different stage of life. They still want to party. You feel like those days are behind you. They're already divorced with a young kid. You still love the idea of traveling. You don't even really know where you want to live yet. And I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying don't let these wonderful feelings of love blind us to the fact that we might be at completely different life stages. In the beginning, nobody wants to ask these hard questions. Nobody wants to talk about what eventual conflicts we might have, what could throw a wrench into this relationship. But countless times we get in over our head and then we resent them because they're essentially stealing our independence now, or they're being irresponsible, when really the warning signs were there all along. We just didn't want to pay attention to them. All right, number four, different values and goals. This is a major issue in relationships. So many of us don't even know what our values are. Whether you know it or not, you have core values. You have goals. You have a vision for what you feel like your life should look like and what your relationships should look like. Get clear on those. Because in the beginning, we're terrified to actually talk about our needs and values, but that's when it matters most. If you have some past trauma, it feels like you're not even allowed to have needs, right? It feels like talking about your non-negotiables would be stupid because, well, you want this person to like you, but that's part of the problem. We should be more concerned with, does this person actually know the real us, than worried about whether or not they like us. We should be more concerned with, does this person align with my values, rather than how can I make them like me more. Never forget that the biggest predictor of relationship success with someone else is how our relationship is with ourselves. Do we know our own value and worth? How do we view ourselves? Are we willing to hold space? Are we practicing self-respect and self-compassion and acceptance? Because how we love ourselves is a massive clue to how we will love someone else, or what we will tolerate in someone else. If your faith is really important to you, and you know that when you have a family, you envision your family going to church every Sunday, if that's really important to you, you need to be talking to any partner that you're getting serious with about that. If you know that honesty and transparency are core values for you, that's something that you need to be discussing with them. If you know that pornography is considered cheating in your eyes, that's something you need to let them know. If you know that you're going to have separate bank accounts, if you know that living near your family and seeing them at least a few times a month is vital for you, then these values need to be expressed. Don't give any room for uncertainty or chance. This is where our boundaries come in. If you have a vision that says, even during a conflict, I still deserve respect and kindness, then it doesn't matter if I like you or not. I need to establish a boundary around anyone who crosses those lines. And remember, a boundary isn't about controlling them. They can still talk however they want. A boundary is about what am I willing to accept and tolerate. I'm not willing to tolerate anyone yelling in my face during a conflict. They can continue to yell. I'm just planning on removing myself from the room because I've already established that boundary with them. And remember, compatibility still matters. Yes, we like them. Yes, we want them to like us. But are we giving them a chance to accept the real us? Or are we pretending to be laid back and chill and then later resent them for not caring about something that was never clearly communicated? So get clear on what your values and needs are. Be bold and courageous enough to tell them so they have a chance to know and accept the real you. I promise you that if they end up leaving because of your honesty, yes, it hurts, but it doesn't hurt as bad as divorce after years of unresolved conflict. All right, number three, baggage and trauma. The sad reality is we all have some baggage from our past. We probably all have some trauma, but not all of us are willing to do the work and start on a healing journey. I think one of the worst things that we can do for our future peace and relational fulfillment is accidentally missing the red flags that someone is carrying baggage from their past into their relationship in the present. Someone smarter than me said, if you don't heal from those who cut you, you'll bleed on those who didn't. And that can be true for your partner, and it can be true for you. So how does this manifest in our relationships? Well, obviously, unhealed trauma can come out in a lot of different ways, but let's just go over some obvious and some overlooked red flags that I believe we have to address if we want a healthy, safe, mutually fulfilling relationship with anyone. The first is any type of abuse. We have to have a zero tolerance policy for any abuse. Unfortunately, when you're in an abusive situation, sometimes it's very hard to see. And this content isn't for people in those situations. I would rather you be talking to a professional than getting any advice from a stranger on the internet, even though that stranger really cares about you. All I'll say is this: you should never be called names. You shouldn't be touched when you don't want to be touched. You shouldn't be demeaned or belittled. You are valuable and worthy of kindness and respect baseline. There is no justification for someone verbally, emotionally, physically, financially, psychologically abusing you. And sometimes due to our past, we forget that it's not okay and it's extremely dangerous. And you deserve safety and consideration and consistency, always. All right, number two is shame, the belief that we're worthless. Brené Brown says that guilt says I did something bad, but shame says I'm bad. And it makes sense if you grew up in homes where your caregivers were consistently hurtful with their words or actions. We come to believe that we must not be worthy of love. But that's not true. The problem is this can severely hurt your relationships. No, you don't have to fully love yourself to be in a healthy relationship, but how you view yourself matters. And a core belief that you're no good can be disastrous to your relationships. It affects everything. So if you have those thoughts, know that you're not alone, but get help. Talk to a professional before you unintentionally sabotage a good, healthy relationship with someone you care about. All right, third is red flags around emotional unavailability or being emotionally immature. And obviously, we can all be immature at times, but here are just some of the red flags I could think of. Someone who is disrespectful, aggressive, confrontational, someone who has to be right. Someone who takes no accountability when they're wrong, or even when they hurt you unintentionally. Someone who can't apologize, doesn't see a need for validation or empathy. Someone who has to escalate the fight because they can't have a calm discussion with you. Someone who is inconsiderate or self-centered. Someone who tries to manipulate or control you. These aren't things that we should just brush off because, well, nobody's perfect. These are red flags. There's a reason the majority of marriages end in divorce or one partner being miserable even if they stay together. We have to do everything we can to set ourselves up for success. This isn't about perfection. This is about direction towards humility and respect and maturity. All right, number four is trust issues. Some people, because of their trauma, understandably so, have a lot of insecurity and trust issues. Sometimes that's because they were hurt so badly in the past that subconsciously they're terrified of truly getting close to someone because closeness only resulted in pain when they were a child. Now, we can have empathy for their past. We can have compassion for their pain or shame, but we still have to hold them accountable to any destructive coping mechanisms or toxic relationship behaviors. We can understand how actual intimacy and vulnerability might terrify them, and we can also acknowledge that closeness and connection and consideration are simply core values for us. We need those to be present in our relationship. And that's okay if it's not a priority for them, but it is for us. That doesn't mean we're abandoning them. It means we're protecting ourselves from unhealthy or unsafe relationships. Because the sad reality is our childhood was a classroom and you were learning things whether you wanted to or not. Some people were punished for trying to get close or connected to their caregivers. So now they're either hypervigilant to stay connected to their partner, always needing constant reassurance that their partner still loves them, always testing their love or picking fights with them just to make sure that they're still worthy enough to fight for, which is also an example of immaturity and unavailability. And it will eventually drive your partner crazy. And their insecure behavior actually becomes the cause of the distance and disconnection that they feared so much and they were trying to prevent so aggressively. They call this being anxiously attached. Or you can have avoidant attachment, where you were neglected by the people who were supposed to love you the most. They weren't there for you when you needed them. You didn't feel like a priority to them. So it's only natural that you come to believe that it's not worth getting close to someone else because those people always hurt you. That's why you run away when someone gets too close. That's why you're fiercely independent. That's why you suppress your feelings and needs, because it makes you very uncomfortable to think about yours or your partner's. So you numb yourself with addictions or your job or superficial sex or food or hobbies. But the point is, those aren't compatible with long-term relationship success. It doesn't mean that they are bad people. It just means that there's work that needs to be done. There's healing that needs to be started. Because when we don't, we unintentionally sabotage even a healthy relationship because we or they aren't capable of actual honesty, vulnerability, and closeness because of our fear. And we all have a choice. If you aren't interested in mutual respect and intimacy and intentionality in your relationships, then you have the option of staying single. No one is forcing you to enter into companionship with someone. I'm just warning you of what's required if you do. What really helped me is answering the question, why do I do the things I do? Figure out why you need them to validate your worth and value. Figure out why you pull away when they need closeness. Figure out why you defend or criticize. There are reasons for all of them, and most of them have to do with us trying to protect ourselves. But that protection isn't serving us anymore. We need to let go of the fear and let go of the shame and show up as our true selves. And yes, be respectful and kind, but also stop apologizing for your needs and desires. Not everyone is for you, but you won't have to beg the right person to care about what you need to feel safe, valued, and loved. All right, number two, love tanks. I personally love this topic. As I mentioned earlier, self-centeredness isn't compatible with relationship success. I personally believe the best relationships are mutually selfless, but not from the standpoint of viewing yourself as unworthy of love and attention, but just the opposite. I know my worth. I know my value. I know what I deserve. I know what I need in relationships, and I can respectfully and vulnerably advocate for those needs. I care about how I'm being treated, but I also care about how you believe you're being treated by me. You find me two people who are both intentional about checking in to make sure their partner feels valued and safe and loved and prioritized and is willing to do anything short of abandoning their boundaries to meet those needs. That's a relationship that will thrive. That's the equation for success. Let's not make relationships more complicated than they are. You have to care about what fills your partner's love tank. You have to care about what helps them to feel prioritized and valued. You have to have a desire to consistently execute those things. And you have to care about what leads them to feeling neglected or rejected, which keeps their tank empty. Now, it's not your sole job to make them happy, but if leaving the dishes in the sink and never washing them for days leaves them feeling neglected, like you're putting that mutual chore all on them, then the solution is really easy. Don't do that anymore. You don't need to make this into a fight and make this a giant thing about your independence and your autonomy, and you should have the freedom to wash the stupid dishes whenever you want to. And if they're going to make such a big deal out of nothing, then they can just wash them themselves, right? What you just did was admit that this isn't about the dishes. This is about you feeling like you're losing your independence. This is about you feeling called out. This is about your shame. Your baggage from the past is being triggered. Your overly critical mom or your emotionally distant dad who said that you would never amount to anything is rising back up in your nervous system, and you're fighting that and making your partner the new enemy. But all they did was tell you that when you leave dishes in the sink, it makes them feel hurt and neglected, like you don't value their time and that you're entitled to them cleaning up after you. But it's our job to recognize when we're triggered and when we're filled with shame and guilt and we're starting to take it out on our partners, and to flip the same script around on you. You told them it would only take them 30 seconds to wash it instead of making such a big deal about nothing. And yet at the same time, you won't take those 30 seconds to wash it and to prevent this conflict in the first place. So let's not start a double standard here. We both need to be on the same team. We both need to be a safe place for our partner to vulnerably and respectfully bring up a complaint or a concern or a desire and not be punished for it. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that they should be a completely negative person and always complaining, nor does it mean that they should criticize you or attack you with their words. But it also shouldn't mean that they can't feel safe to bring up an issue because you throw it back in their face, blow up, shut down, invalidate them, mock them, get defensive, dismiss their feelings entirely, because both of those things hurt relationships. But back to our point, what fills their love tank? Is it appreciation? Is it time together? Is it one-on-one time where you put your phones down and you just talk? Is it when you write those little sticky notes to her in her mirror in the morning? Is it when he feels sexually desired by you? Is it when you flirt with him? Is it when he feels respected by you? when you defer to him and trust his judgment? Is it when you prioritize emotional connection and actual intimacy with her, where you ask her questions about her day and her stress and what's on her heart, when you touch her and kiss her and don't push for the bedroom? Is it when you check in with her to make sure she doesn't feel overwhelmed, when you take on mutual chores without having to be asked because you love her and you can tell that she's taking on too much? Ask them. Ask them to be specific. Ask them what behaviors caused them to fall in love with you in the first place. Ask them what you could do this week to fill their love tank, and then do it. That's what builds trust, consistency, filling our partner's emotional love banks. Because I believe that in every moment, every conversation, we get a chance, an opportunity to move closer together or drift farther apart. And trust me, the natural state of your relationship with work and kids and aging parents and money and stress, it's all going to pull you apart if you're not intentional. Every opportunity you have to reconnect and repair conflicts and remind them how much they mean to you and do something sweet for them, practice consideration, thoughtfulness, every moment needs to be capitalized on, because we will always be swimming against the current when it comes to all the things trying to cause us to drift apart. It's not easy, it's just necessary. And number one is communication. It was always going to be communication, because when we get communication wrong, this entire thing crumbles. I don't think you can have friendship and intimacy and trust and safety without communication, right? The presence of it either builds up or tears down all those other essential aspects. So it's vital we get this right. And people always say, oh, you just need to communicate more. But they're missing a vital component. Because if one of you is unhealed or emotionally immature, more communication won't solve anything. You could give me a calculus test as many times as you want. I would continue to fail it. Me taking the calculus tests aren't the problem. It's the fact that I don't understand calculus. That's the problem. And it's the same for communication. More of the wrong type of communication that's filled with shame and blame and self-loathing and disrespect and aggression and defensiveness and criticism and contempt and passive aggressiveness and dismissing someone's feelings or name-calling. More of that type of communication will only make things worse every time. So what do we do? Well, first we eliminate those things. We have a zero tolerance policy for those. We've already set boundaries around those. If my wife and I did anything that checked one of those boxes, we would automatically take a timeout for 30 minutes and come back to the conflict once we're less triggered and we've apologized for those hurtful words. That's a core value for both of us. That's why it's so important to discuss and agree upon your boundaries and needs around conflict and communication and how to repair. You should map out what an optimal conflict should look like and then figure out how to practice that and make it a reality. My advice, be a safe place for your partner to bring something up. But also, when we have a complaint, we bring it up with kindness and respect and vulnerability. We don't say, you never take me anywhere. You're such a selfish narcissist. No, that's only going to do one thing, and that's going to immediately trigger a defensive reaction. It would be the same for me. Those are fighting words. So, of course, our body's going to go into fight or flight mode. That's just how we're all wired. Instead, we say, can I talk to you about something that's on my heart? I know you haven't meant to do this, but I've been feeling very hurt and alone because you've been working so much lately. And I know you're doing it for our family, but I'm just telling you my feelings surrounding it. Remember those times that you used to take me out on those surprise dates and we would just watch the sunset and talk about our life together? I can't even tell you how much I loved those times with you. Would you be willing to do that for me again? Now, of course, it feels wrong when we have to tell someone what we want from them. And absolutely, a huge part of relationships is anticipating someone else's needs, which we should absolutely do. But at the same time, we all get stuck. We all unintentionally ignore our partner, and it's nice when they tell us exactly what they want to feel loved. Now, does this mean just because we tell someone how to fill our love tanks, or you tell someone what you're feeling, that they will react with kindness and consideration? No, of course not. Because unfortunately, it always takes two people for trust and safety and intimacy to be experienced. If they can't or won't do the work, then unfortunately, we won't achieve those in this relationship. So if someone who is important to you tells you that you unintentionally hurt them in some way, please don't get triggered and get defensive and tell them they shouldn't feel that way and nothing you do will ever be good enough, because that's the opposite of trust and safety. That makes them not want to bring up any concern to you in the future. All they want from you in this moment is to know that you care about how they're feeling, to be curious, ask them what led them to feel that way. Get in their shoes, see it from their lens. Of course it's hard, but it's necessary. This is what makes empathy so powerful in our relationships. You're saying, you matter to me. I care. It makes sense that you would feel that way. It wasn't my intention to hurt you, and I want you to feel prioritized because I love you. And that helps people feel safe and loved and heard and validated. And you can do that. I mean, that might sound dumb to you, but that is how a discussion can go. They can approach you with vulnerability and respect and kindness and without blame, and you cannot get defensive or invalidate them. Don't you think that approach would potentially be better than what you're doing before? Isn't it worth a try? Because in my opinion, the way we handle these moments, it might seem insignificant, but I think it makes or breaks the entire relationship. I can tell you firsthand, safety and trust can be lost very quickly when we don't realize how extremely hurtful invalidation and defensiveness and interrupting and trying to prove that they're unfairly attacking you can be. It's extremely hurtful. And of course, some people right now are saying, well, I'm willing to do that stuff, but my partner isn't. And in those situations, all we can do is get professional help. Because if we don't, resentment is going to develop. We need to keep short accounts in this relationship. We need to learn how to manage conflict. And professional help is the best way we can do that. And lastly, let me just say this. So much of this stuff won't come natural, and you're going to be scared to fail, but don't let shame get the best of you. Don't let your fear cause distance and disconnection. Be honest, be vulnerable, learn about your needs and desires, learn about your fears, learn about your triggers and what triggers your partner, and have empathy for each other, but also assertiveness to hold each other accountable. This is what love requires of all of us. Good luck out there, and know that I'm... All right, today we're going to be talking about what are healthy needs versus unhealthy needs in a relationship, because the reality is, underneath most of our fights are hidden needs and desires that we're not communicating, either because we're not fully aware of them or because we don't even feel safe to express them. You're not just fighting about the dishes. You're fighting to feel valued, right? You're not just fighting about the bedroom. You're fighting to feel desired and accepted. And you're not just fighting about work. You're fighting to be appreciated. So today I just want to remind you, it's okay that you have needs. It's even more than okay. It's inevitable. You do have needs. You can't not. And one of the best things that we can do in our relationship is admit and acknowledge to ourselves and our partner, I need certain things in order to feel connected in this relationship. That doesn't make me too needy. It just makes me human. And a mutually fulfilling relationship requires both of you to care about, be sensitive towards, and prioritize your partner's appropriate needs. We have to care about what they need to feel safe, loved, and valued. One of those healthy needs is respect. Even people who don't think they have needs still need respect in their relationship, don't they? Respect means they treat you like an equal. Respect means your opinions and perspectives are valued and considered. Respect means holding someone in high regard. That means I speak to you with words that reflect appreciation and admiration for you, even if we disagree. We can all agree respect is necessary for a relationship to survive. If you don't feel respected, you will not feel close or connected to that person, right? How about the need to be able to communicate effectively with kindness and respect? Completely healthy need. So often how you communicate, especially how you communicate together during a conflict, completely makes or breaks your entire relationship. In fact, doctors John and Julie Gottman studied thousands of couples, and they found that the way you handled the first 3 minutes of a conflict determined whether or not you were still together 6 years later. How we communicate matters. Are you being kind in your communication? Are you bringing things up with respectful vulnerability, without criticism or blame or yelling or passive aggressiveness? Because those things never help. They only hurt the discussion. And on the other side, if your partner was to bring something up, a feeling, a concern, or need, can you respect them enough to hold space for what they're trying to communicate without immediately launching into defensiveness or dismissiveness or invalidating them? How about the need to feel valued and appreciated in our relationship? Don't we all have that one? How about the need to feel safe physically and emotionally? Safe to say no. Safe to know that your boundaries are going to be respected and honored. Safe to bring something up and feel heard and understood. These things aren't optional. They are healthy needs in a relationship. If we actually want trust and intimacy and passion, like we all say we do, these are the blueprints. This is the path. Work towards meeting your partner's legitimate needs mutually. You can pause this video right now if you're watching it together and just ask them, what does respect look like to you? How important is communication, especially during a conflict? How do you feel appreciated most? It's not too needy to need a partner who is consistent, someone who follows through on their word. You don't trust people who say they're going to do one thing but end up doing another. And it's the same in your relationship. It's normal to need mutual accountability. Neither of you are perfect. You're going to mess up. But when we do, can we take accountability? Not just by saying you're sorry, but by intentionally moving towards understanding how our words and actions impacted them. Our disconnection and rebuild trust. We put aside our ego and shame and we ask, how are you feeling about that? What led to you feeling that way? What meaning did you give my actions? What were you needing in that moment that you weren't getting? Respect, appreciation, closeness, equality. That's what's underneath all these fights. And when we validate those feelings and needs as real, it helps them to feel close to us. Validation sounds like that makes sense, or I can see that, or man, I don't want you to feel disconnected and dismissed. Thank you for telling me this. Invalidation sounds like you're just being too sensitive. You're really going to make a big deal about that? It completely pushes your partner away and discourages them from ever wanting to be vulnerable with you again. Cheap apologies are fine, I'm sorry. Or I'm sorry that you feel that way. Geez, it was just a joke. Can't you get over it? Real apologies? I care about how my words and actions impact you. It wasn't my intention to hurt you, but I can see now that when this happened, you felt this way. And this was my role in that. I'm sorry. I should have handled that situation this way, which I'll do from now on. Is there anything else that you want to tell me about it? Because I want you to feel heard and understood. Now, if your complaint is, I've done that. I've tried to validate and empathize. I apologize all the time. They still hold it over my head or throw it in my face during an argument a year later. Okay, so what might be happening is they might have a block around forgiveness for some reason. Or they don't feel like their pain was ever actually validated. Or they simply want to hold on to the resentment because that's easier than actually moving forward. Either way, you need to get into a counselor about that because there's something deeper going on. Because make no mistake, another healthy need in a relationship is forgiveness. We have to keep short accounts, right? We can't let resentment grow. And you and I both know it's not mature to throw past mistakes in people's faces during an argument. It's not healthy to hold on to resentment and not be working towards healing that. I can understand if you're still hurt, but you know that that's impacting your relationship. You should be making those counseling appointments to try to heal some of those wounds. Because you know that I want your partner to explore those old hurts. I want your partner to learn how to validate past wounds. I want them to empathize with you and rebuild trust for any betrayals, large or small. But that doesn't change the fact that if you're never planning on forgiving them, regardless of the work that they put into healing, and you still want to hurt them with your words and actions because of how much they've hurt you in the past, you know that's not healthy. You think you're actually going to feel better once you finally hurt them to the level of pain that you felt? You won't. So please talk to someone about that. Another appropriate need is affection and feeling desired by your partner. I realize there's 100 things that impact that. It's really hard to be affectionate with someone who dismisses your feelings. It's hard to have desire for someone who hasn't been a safe place for you emotionally. That's why I'm so vocal about how damaging invalidation and defensiveness are. And on the other side, how destructive constant criticism or contempt is. The truth is we all have something we need to own. We've all hurt each other, but we need to take accountability for our side of the street before you figure out a way to make excuses for what you said or did because, well, they're worse. Here's an example of what taking responsibility would sound like where you're empathizing with their experience. It makes sense why you were scared to be vulnerable with me. I took a lot of what you said as an attack and I dismissed you and invalidated you. I'm so sorry. I imagine that left you feeling pretty abandoned and alone in this relationship. And I just need you to know I'm committed to understanding how my words and actions impacted you. And I want to learn how to be a safe place for you again, because you deserve that. That's healing. Or on the other side, maybe it's appropriate for you to say, it makes sense why you jumped to defensiveness. I wasn't actually being vulnerable with you. I was using a lot of blame and assuming your intent, and that was wrong, and I'm sorry. I bet that left you feeling pretty unappreciated or unfairly attacked, like I was looking out for ways that you were messing up so I could call you a failure. I certainly don't want that to be your experience. I want you to feel appreciated and valued in this relationship. I mean, we need to ask ourselves, why can't we say that to each other? What's stopping us? I mean, sometimes we just don't know the words to say, but I just gave you the words, so let's say them. It doesn't work if only one of you is doing this. We both need to have a desire to move towards each other. I understand if you're scared to do that. You probably have every right to be scared, but that doesn't change the fact that we need to be working towards healing if we're ever going to achieve the relationship we deserve. All right, next need. How about the need to accept each other's influence? Going back to the Gottmans, Dr. John Gottman said that when a man especially doesn't share power or accept influence of his partner, that relationship had an 81% chance of self-destructing. Now, I don't mean to pick on men more here. Women, of course, need to accept the influence of their partner as well. But the research was clear. Women are more likely to do that, and men aren't. So yes, we need to accept our partner's influence. Remember, this is someone we're supposed to trust. This is someone who is supposed to be on our team. And when you're on a team with someone, and you trust them, and they give you constructive feedback, what do you do? Do you tell them they're crazy? Do you dismiss what they said as stupid? Do you get all bent out of shape and get defensive? No, if you actually trust them, you listen because you believe they're on your team. They're on your side. Now, I'm certainly not saying that they can talk to you however they want. I'm saying sometimes, if we're honest, it doesn't matter how they bring it up. We were going to get defensive or take it as an attack anyways. And the research is clear. You can destroy your relationship by constantly criticizing your partner and being harsh, absolutely. But on the other side, we as men especially can destroy it by refusing to even take calm, respectful feedback as helpful information. And we actually punish our partners for being vulnerable and honest. They both have consequences. How about the need for equality when it comes to the domestic labor and the mutual chores and parenting? Regardless of how you feel about those issues, if we want to have a mutually fulfilling relationship with someone, we should care about whether or not they feel like we're equals in that department, right? I know if you're both respectful and kind and vulnerable, you can figure out a way to collaborate on how to make those things work for both of you. I believe in you. How about the need for attention? Like, I need time with you. I can't really feel close to someone who doesn't really want to spend time with me. And like I said, you might disagree on how much time is appropriate, but we're talking about making this relationship work for both of you. I mean, maybe you're not compatible with each other, and that's okay. You don't have to fulfill all of their needs. But is this one important for them? Are they important enough to you to figure out a way to bend in their direction? If not, then we need to ask, why not? Do you feel like you're always the one that's bending? Do you feel like if you bend in their direction, you're going to be losing a part of yourself? Or maybe you're susceptible to being controlled in some way? These are important questions that you should both feel safe enough to explore together. Maybe you have more of a need for independence. That's okay. No one said that's wrong. We're simply here to talk about what can work for your relationship. If your partner feels prioritized and valued in lots of different ways, I would hope that they would be perfectly fine with honoring your need for independence by encouraging you to go off and do stuff. That, of course, doesn't mean abandoning your responsibilities with your family, but I just hope that they could honor the fact that in order for you to feel valued in your relationship, you need more space. And that's okay. I'm not trying to turn you both into each other. I'm trying to figure out a way where we can meet each other's needs so you both feel fulfilled. Maybe that's possible. Maybe that's not. At the end of the day, either option is okay. But if you want to stay together, then we have to try the first one. Because the reason we break up or fight all the time is usually buried in these needs staying hidden or going unmet. It's as simple as that. You really want to stop fighting in your relationship? Ask each other, do you feel appreciated? Do you feel valued? Do you feel respected? I don't mean perfectly, I mean consistently. Do you feel like you can trust me? Do you feel safe to be honest with me? That's another need. Do you feel like you can rely on me? Because if the answer is no, that's why you're fighting. And I get it, you might be a trustworthy person, and they just don't trust you. Absolutely. Sometimes due to trauma in the past, we have our own trust issues. That's something that they should be talking with a counselor about. The way I like to think about it is this. What if it was the opposite? Would a relationship work if your partner didn't take accountability or rarely, if ever, apologized? Would this work if they couldn't care less how their behavior or words affected you? No, of course not. Would intimacy be possible if you didn't feel valued or respected or safe? No. So let's get in the habit of at least admitting we need certain things in order to feel close and connected to someone else. That's not wrong. It's being a human. It's called maturity, and it helps get you the relationship that you eventually deserve. And it's important that I mention, I'm not saying that you are your partner's personal need-fulfilling machine. We should be getting our needs met for connection and closeness in lots of different ways. Family, friends, hobbies, and our partner. I'm not saying our partner should be the only source of our needs being met, but I am saying, are you trying to meet the ones that you can? Because there's certain needs that only you can meet for them. I want to meet those needs in my wife, and I hope that you want to meet them in your partner as well. Okay, but what about the needs that they can't or won't meet? Terry Real has a really amazing quote on this. He says, "Are enough of my needs being met that I can grieve the ones that aren't?" And I think that sums up our dilemma perfectly. Are enough of my needs being met to grieve the ones that aren't? Because if the answer is yes, then we grieve and we move on, knowing that no relationship is going to be perfect for us, but this one is good enough, and we can find gratitude in that. If the answer is no, then you are not going to feel close or connected in this relationship if nothing changes. Now, does that mean leave? That's up to you. But there's one thing I know, and that's intimacy and connection require things from both of us, right? And if you have a partner who doesn't have an interest in meeting any of those needs that we talked about, then you will continue to feel disconnected and alone in this relationship because that's simply where that path leads. Some people choose to stay in those relationships for a lot of reasons, and they try to get their needs met elsewhere. Other people leave. I'm not here to say what's right or wrong for you. I am here to hopefully remind you and your partner to put actions behind your words. Don't tell me you love each other if you can't have hard conversations with kindness, empathy, and respect. Don't tell me you love each other, but you're both not willing to work towards mutual sacrifice and service towards each other and asking each other, what does it look like for you to feel valued and loved in this relationship? Don't tell me you love each other, but you're not willing to try something new when it comes to conflict and learn how to practice respectful vulnerability. When this happened, I'm feeling this. Name a feeling, not I feel like you don't care. That's not a feeling. And on the flip side, you're learning how to listen and validate and practice compassionate curiosity towards the person you say you love. These things aren't optional. This is what determines whether your relationship house stands strong or crashes to the ground. All right, so those are some of the most common healthy needs. I'm sure I missed a few, so write in the comments which ones I missed, but let's briefly talk about what are some inappropriate or unhealthy needs, because those are important to know as well. The first one that comes to mind is control, the need to dominate our partner or dictate their actions. This is an inappropriate need. And I believe you that it feels very real to you. You want to control them or protect the relationship, but in doing so, you're pushing them away. What you're actually trying to do is control your own fear and anxiety, but you're using this other person to do that, and that's how they feel, used and dominated. And no one actually feels valued when they're being controlled. And just to clear something up, boundaries are not about controlling someone. If your partner sets a healthy boundary, as in, I will not tolerate being called names or being belittled or yelled at during a conflict, if that happens, I will remove myself for 30 minutes and then come back when we're both cooled off. That's a perfectly appropriate boundary. That is not controlling you. They are not forcing you to do anything. A boundary isn't about control. It's about what I'm going to do because I can't control you. All I can control is me. A boundary is here's what I'm going to do. It requires nothing from you. But having said that, if they've expressed that boundary and you continue to yell or call names during a conflict and they leave, if you follow them, yelling and escalating the conflict, you are severely damaging that relationship. The next unhealthy need is constant reassurance. We should not be looking towards our partner to reassure us that we are loved and valued constantly. Yes, there's an appropriate version of this, but there's also an inappropriate version of this. How can you tell the difference? One is solely based in fear. I'm testing your love. I'm asking you to prove your love, and I'm constantly searching for reassurance because of the fact that I don't trust this relationship. Even when things are going well, I'm anxious and fearful that any minute that could change. But in my hypervigilance, I'm actually creating the disconnection that I'm trying to prevent because nobody wants to be tested all the time. Nobody wants to feel like if they don't tell you that they love you 35 times a day, then you're going to get upset or start a fight. That's only going to cause someone to slowly pull away, which is exactly what you were trying to avoid. Another unhealthy need is avoidance or fierce independence. Maybe you enjoy connecting with someone, but you hate the idea of getting too close. You like to stay away from labels. You like your independence. And if someone starts to get too close, you pull away. Or maybe you are actually officially together with them, but you just avoid the issues. You dismiss them. You downplay them. You disregard them because you're conflict avoidant. The problem is that person will eventually end it because they can't feel close to you if they can't bring up issues or feel heard and understood.
That's it. Did you guys hear? You guys heard, Moss. So, good evening to you. If you have just been listening and just been participating and taking notes, I hope that we are learning. Happy December.
So we are officially here. So the countdown begins now already. 30 more days to next year. it's almost 30 days, 30 more days, 30 more days. And then we are done with December. And then we are already in 2026 where we can make our New Year resolution and our fake promises to ourselves and our fitness goals. And we can all do all of that. But if there is a takeaway that we can take from all of this, ladies and gentlemen, is look at the green flags, look at the red flags, combine them. Look at what is healthy and what is unhealthy within your relationships, all your relationships. I think that this is definitely December types of conversations so that you know.